Hello, and welcome to Ladies with Gumption, episode 68, Back to Life, Back to Reality, which for some reason makes me want to sing an Evanescence song. Anyway.
That's not the song I'm thinking of, but okay, that works.
What song were you thinking of?
Literally, Back to Life, Back to Reality.
Oh, nope. Okay. Yes, I do. Okay. That song. I do know that song. When you got the reality part, I know that part.
This is Ladies with Gumption, the musical stylings.
Anyway.
We are the Ladies with Gumption. We recap DCTV in a flash. I am Tatiana, and I'm here with...
Jessica.
And May.
Wonderful. And you can contact us at DCTVGumption on Twitter, at LadiesWGumption on Tumblr, or... at ladieswgumption@gmail.com. Also, you could, if you wanted to, leave us a review on iTunes. That would be amazing, because I feel like y'all are cool, and you think we're cool, but you don't say that we're cool on iTunes. And you really should. Also, we are on Facebook and Google Play if you choose to access those avenues. In the news, I... was not able to watch 10 through 12 or whatever was airing right now because I am the worst and had too much work to do. But Jessica will share her feelings about 7 through 9.
First, I have to remember my feelings about 7 through 9. Like, I remember last week you were saying that it felt a little bit crowded, these three episodes, because there are so many different plots going on. I feel like, if you look at it in chunks, like, the first three set up, like, the first act of the season, and then you have 4 through 6 with a little bit of like filler episodes, and then 7 through 9 is again setting up like the second act. So the first act is from the point of view of the heroes, and 7 through 9 really dives more into the villains and setting up the arc from that side. And so you get a lot of I think 7 had to do with a lot of Vandal Savage. So you get that history. There is the introduction of a major character that I will not spoil, but I think it's going to be super big in terms of the overall mystery of the plot. Actually, there's two of them that are introduced. You get the episode 9, of course, with all the moms and like the superhero daycare, which is really, really cute. And then you get more of what I liked, the Outsiders team with Halo, Forager, and Geoforce, Breon. A lot of them, like, training together and kind of, like, starting to gel. Breon and Violet, who's Halo, are really cute. But probably the only negative thing that I will say about the series as a whole is just seeing all the graphic depictions of Halo dying. Like, part of her powers is that she is mortal, but like I don't need to see her die every time she fights. It's almost to the point where it's like Iris getting stabbed in the chest by Savitar. Like, I don't need to see it. I get it. She's immortal. I don't need to see it every time.
Agreed.
So don't like that.
I
don't think so. And I think the other thing
myself.
Oh, okay. The other thing that is kind of, it's also a big kind of spoilery thing, but you get more of an explanation to something that happened in the first three sets of episodes. So that's a lot of, that's me saying a lot of nothing, but something. it's really something, a lot of nothing. But I'm really enjoying it, and so I look forward to seeing the next four episodes this weekend, and then, you know, me and Tati will be on the same page, or she'll have seen the next six episodes or something. I don't know. Anyways.
There's a break after 13, so I think...
This is, like, coming up to, like, I guess the mid-season finale, and then you get no more episodes until June, I think, so...
Yeah.
Everybody can cry together.
Anyway, we've got plenty of news. So, first we'll just go with the one that broke today, which is the Batwoman casting. We finally got a little bit of the cast for Batwoman, and it looks pretty exciting. Megan Tandy, Camrys Johnson, and Nicole Kang are all going to be co-starring in the Batwoman pilot. And we know that Megan Tandy is playing Sophie Moore. So remember when I said, like, oh, it might not be Renee, it might be Sophie, who is the random girl that she dated back in West Point?
Yeah.
That explains who it is. It is Sophie. So no Renee Montoya, but Sophie Moore is going to be clearly a protagonist, and I'm guessing that's going to be like the love story for the show. Yes, despite her bite and regimented outlook, Sophie has a soft side illuminated by Kate Kane's return. Dun, dun, dun. Cameras Johnson is playing Luke Fox, so Batwing, and he is the son of Lucius Fox. He works to secure Wayne Tower in his boss's absence and considers himself the guardian of all things Batman. So clearly he's going to be the Cisco slash... Can you be like a Cisco-Alfred duo? Like, can you like a combination?
But that's what he would be. Yeah.
Anything is possible.
like a cool, hip Alfred.
Well, that's a Diggle, right? So he'd be like a Cisco-Diggle combo.
I guess it's like a Diggle. Yeah, this is a Diggle combo. Anyway, and then Kang is playing Mary Hamilton, who, interestingly enough, is Kate Kane's stepsister, which I was not expecting her to have that sister. But there you go. They're expanding her current family. So her dad remarried, then this is the stepmom's daughter. And she is Kate Kane's polar opposite, excitable, talkative, and an influencer in the making. Ooh. But she's very compassionate and cares about Gotham's underserved communities. So that's cool. She sounds like a cool character. Yeah. And that's that on that. So moving on. Oh, Kang was one of the friends in You. She's,
Yes.
And I can't remember her name. Not Annabelle, not Peach. The other one.
Yeah, I can't remember her name. I know who you're talking about.
Yeah. The one who was like, none of us liked Peach, but we loved her.
Yes. The iconic line.
I'm very suspiciously optimistic about these Batwoman castings because it's already passing like my diversity threshold for TV, and then it has two women of color, it has a man of color, and then the lead is LGBT IRL as well. So I'm suspicious because I'm waiting for something to happen.
No, it would be better if you said 2WC, 1MOC, and then you could just kept going with all of the acronyms because it was like LGBT IRL, like it's not at all. Moving on. Speaking of diverse casting, Titans is casting a deaf actor, a man who is mixed Latinx or Asian, 21 to 24 years old, who longs to inflict pain on all those who have caused him pain, and it's a series regular role, which is really interesting. If you guys have any guesses on who it might be, that would be awesome. And in fact, Andy was right about this, and I'm pretty sure hashtag show already broke the news. That it's going to be Jericho. Deathstroke.
So we're getting Deathstroke and his son, and his daughter, Ravager.
Right, which is crazy, because I'm like, y'all already don't do enough with the characters you do have, but I'm excited to see Jericho, and I'm excited to see their take on Deathstroke, that's the words.
Yeah, because they said that they're changing up his background, obviously, and he's like a, in this verse, military guy, super, like, controlling or whatever, as far as, like, how he runs his family, and, like, he runs, like, a tight ship or whatever, and so they're coming at it from that side, so it'll be interesting to see how all of that plays out.
Agreed. Then we just learned this, that Melissa Benoist and Carlos Vives starred in a short film by Chris Wood. It's called The Stew, and the plot synopsis is that it follows a man and woman stubbornly staying in their toxic marriage. So that's of interest. Like,
I think I knew, like, tangentially that it was happening out in the atmosphere, but it's just now being just released.
Okay. I definitely did not know about it.
Yeah, I saw the poster and I'm like, oh, what?
Yeah. I knew it was a thing, but now it's being released into the atmosphere.
Yes. Isn't it going to be at Sundance?
Yeah, I think so. That's probably why they released the poster.
That's what I heard. But yeah.
Because there's like no other information on IMDb but the one line of synopsis, nothing in the news feed.
Right. And we also, speak speaking of posters, because we got a poster for that movie, we also got a poster revealing our first look at John Cryer as Lex Luthor. What do we think?
And we cried. I cried, but not happy tears.
He really looks like he could be Lena's dad.
Yep.
Yes.
I don't really like it, but that's all right. We've learned that he's going to appear in a March episode called Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And I saw the synopsis, and then I promptly X'd out of it, and now I do not have the synopsis anymore. But I am finding it now so that I can read it to you.
Something was so about close, like, Lex wanting her to join him in some kind of criminal endeavor. I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Okay. He will stop at nothing to get her on board because he wants to rub her into one of his plans. And right. Even if that means leveraging the life of one of her friends. What friend do we think it'll be? I will tell y'all in my predictions. I mean, I'm sure y'all already know, but moving on. Last but not least of all, Nafisa Williams joins Black and Blue alongside Mike Colter and Naomi Harris. So congrats, Nafisa. Snaps, four for Nafisa. Now we'll move on to our feedback reception. We've got a couple of Tumblr anons, which we'll just summarize and respond to. So I know that you guys already responded to, is West Allen the anchor ship of the Arrowverse?
Yeah, so I am of the view, and I answered this on Tumblr already, so if you want to scroll down and find
it. I'm looking for it.
But I said that I don't think it is. I think it's just like a massive submarine ship that keeps the whole Arrowverse from imploding, because even in the crossovers, Oliver is still presented as the lead. It's not Barry. And yes, Elicity is always built on top of West Allen instead of the other way around. So, like, West Allen is, like, a really solid foundation because Elicity is kind of a shaky ship to lead the Arrowverse. But Elicity is always built on top of West Allen, and that romance story becomes the focus even if they're not used anywhere in, like, promotion or whatever. It always becomes about Elicity in the crossovers instead of
also it just
West Allen.
It came first, like,
right.
Arrow came first, Elicity came first, so it was, you know, Arrow's the anchor show, Oliver is the lead, so that would make Elicity the anchor ship, but by default, because they don't actually do it, right? But yes, so no, it is not. Good times.
Yeah, I was actually going to say the same thing until I saw Jess's answer. I was like, no, that makes sense. Such a wise person.
And then we had another one that I had forgot to put in, like, a previous episode to talk about, but Anon asked what our impressions of E1 Laurel Lance were when we watched the show, because, you know, it's just so many people didn't like her. And I was saying that in the beginning, like, I started watching Arrow around, like, season 3, because I had just got caught up on The Flash, and I knew that the crossover was coming with Arrow, so I wanted to binge Arrow, and it was available on Netflix, so I just kind of binged it. But I already had kind of an impression, looking up, like, articles and stuff about Arrow, that the one thing that was very obvious to me was that the fandom did not like Laurel. And they thought that Felicity and Elicity was the shit, and that Laura was literally the shit, you know? And I tried not to, I had that in the back of my mind, I tried not to let it, like, affect my viewing, because I wanted to see, well, would I come to the same conclusion as the rest of fandom? And I didn't really have any strong feelings about Laurel as I watched, but I think that for me it was very obvious that a lot of things were stacked against her, and the narrative put her in positions that she couldn't win a lot of the time. So I definitely got that kind of impression of it. What did you guys, I know Tati, you saw it from, like, the beginning, right?
Yes, I did watch the beginning, and I loved Laurel, but from the first episode, I could tell that they were not going to do her right, because they didn't give her the name Dinah. They gave her the name Laurel. So then they called her Laurel, and they made her a lawyer. I was like, okay, they don't care about her, and this is a problem. But But I was very protective of Laurel when I was watching in the first like season, because she was treated so terribly by the narrative. Like, she was made to be the villain when she was actually the victim.
Yeah.
So that was a problem. I really liked her. I thought she was strong. You know, she always fought for justice. She wanted to help everybody, and she was like very angry, but it was like a righteous anger. Like, it was interesting to see a character who was allowed to be, like, a female character who was allowed to be so angry and to hold on to that anger and resentment, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And for a while, have people still believe her to be entitled to it and allow her that space. And then in season two, they were like, fuck you, here's Sarah. I loved you for half my life while I was cheating on everyone, and I'm done now. So.
Yeah,
for a while there, I was like, this is great.
I watched from the very beginning, too, but completely devoid of any fandom stuff that was going on, but I do remember liking her as well, and I always thought that, like, why is the narrative really hard on her? You know, every time something would come up, whether it was her sister was dying, then she had the drug thing in season two, and it's just like always something for her. And I thought that what I thought was interesting was that she did parallel all of her, like, the anger drove her, but like she wasn't treated like she was justified in it within the story. But I remember liking her, and I remember feeling like I understood where she was coming from, despite where no one else did.
Yeah. She was set up to fail a lot of times, I feel like, within the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. That's not cool, but it's cool that we discussed this. Now we can move on to our emails. So, we have got an email from the lovely Shang. Everyone is back except Legends, my superior show. God, I miss them. That is the perfect title. Anyway, what does Shang have to say? Hey there, lovely ladies. Hey there, lovely Shang. So we both called each other lovely. Perfect. We're on the same wavelength. I question myself every week why I still watch Supergirl. And it's because I love the Danvers sisters. Big sigh. So he thought that he gave the shrug emoji for Guardian Core, and it because it took James 84 years to apologize, and then Lena took it back immediately. Ain't realistic at all. Well, all right. And then seeing how the writers still want them together, he hopes that James tells Lena about how dangerous her trials are. Oh, Shang. Sweet Shang. Number two. Standard protocol with tender age aliens. So, are the writers going to
Tinder age aliens? I was like, oh,
Tinder age. Yeah, in this age of Tinder, this is how we deal with aliens. Are the writers going to expand on the fact that the U.S. government has multiple squads of trapped, traumatized aliens, racist child soldiers, or will they continue to just go to talk about how to reach to the humanity of the humans? That's a great question. I'm sure they will not delve into that, but we'll see. He's literally furious about the direction the writers have taken with Paley. How many POC have already spouted anti-alien BS from 10 episodes? This is true. Why are only the white people considered having higher morals? Colonel Paley is honestly irredeemable at this point due to her actions, and I hate it. It's even more infuriating that in an upcoming episode, you're like, I have other feelings. Supergirl will take it upon himself to make a xenophobic white man see the light, because all white men are worthy of TLC and redemption. That's, you know, that is a good question. That is a good question. Why is that the case?
I will try to answer that for you, King. I will try to answer that for you.
The Danvers sisters had me in a chokehold and I'm not going to recover until Alex gets her memories back. Sad face. On to something more serious. Breaking the core dynamic of the show is not a plot of the week. Kara and Alex are the foundation of each other's characters, and when you erase that development and treat it as anything less than a half-season arc at minimum, it's an insult. So hopefully it will be a full arc. Or maybe John can just, like, reverse engineer her memories in the next episode. But, like, this did not go as planned. Have your memories back, Alex. This never happened. Alright. On to Tasha, our resident, I guess Shang could be our resident Supergirl correspondent.
Yeah.
And Tasha is our resident Air correspondent. So, where's our resident Flash correspondent, y'all? It's us. We are our resident Flash correspondent.
That position has Haley.
Exactly. Since Stephen and Mel was still filming the crossover, this was a good episode to shift the focus to the other characters. The problem that I had was a lot of time was spent on characters I didn't particularly like, Renee and Diaz. That said, it got me invested in Emma's character. I was about to say something, but I'm not gonna make that joke. I'm not gonna make that joke. It's fine. Okay. So she was glad they didn't drive out the reveal that Emiko is Oliver's sister. Felicity realized that Thea killed Sarah back in season 3 based on Oliver's DNA sequence, so if she didn't figure it out that way this time, it would have been lazy. True. Emiko's angry and grieving. Oliver's gonna have a hard time bonding because she isn't in a trusting mood. But Felicity is right. She wants a connection. That's why she took on his persona. I agree with that. She feels bad for Oliver. He's dedicated himself to honoring his father and righting his wrongs. To find out that Robert abandoned a family is heartbreaking. This is true. Oliver's not perfect. He may not be the perfect dad, but he tried to have a relationship with William. And the only time that they've been separated is because of a physical threat. And yes, Moira was a mess. She had Robert raise Thea, but rejected his biological daughter. This is true.
Because he was dishonest with her. At least she told him up front, look, she's not yours.
There you go. Maybe that's why. Or maybe, I don't know, like, we don't know that Moira made him do that, right? That's just their assumption. True. They should assume that Moira made him do it. I don't know. We'll see. No, we won't see. They won't care. They're just going to villainize Moira. It's fine.
But, okay. he sent the letter after he was dead, so technically, she wouldn't have known when he was still alive. I don't know.
maybe. The pod person that replaced Diggle is still walking around, I see. This man judged Lila from season 2 for her part in Suicide Squad, and now he's forcing her to restart it. Right? Anyway, he's questioned Felicity's heroism for working with Siren, but he's sneaking around with Diaz. I need normal Diggle back. She's unsurprised that future Renee is shady. He's betrayed Oliver and the team before. As soon as Dinah said he should run for office, I predicted that he was the one who went evil in the future, not Felicity. Side note, the wig is awful, and I'm mildly curious about the fight Dinah mentioned. We will talk about your predictions in our predictions, because yours are always better than ours. So,
it's like the CW employees, like, they just put dead animals on people's heads. I don't understand what's going on with that, the hair situation.
we got new feedback from Rachel. I'm not sure if we've gotten... Is Rachel's giving us feedback for or not? If you have before, I apologize, but it's nice to see you. So, hi, ladies. A big fan. What do you think will happen to Nora at the end of the season? The way I see it, Homegirl will either A, exist as she is now and go back to a different future with knowledge of the previous timeline, B, end up having a twin when she goes back, because I don't think she has one as of now, or C, erase herself after existence and Barry and Iris have completely new kids but remember Nora even though she's lost in time. So what do you guys think?
I think based on Todd's slip of the tongue, because I don't think it was a typo, I think she already has a twin, but that she hasn't said anything about him yet. And I think that once we start to see future Iris stuff, we'll see him too, potentially. But I think that she'll end up going back to a future where some stuff has changed and that she has lived forever with both of her parents. I like happy endings.
I think that, because I don't think she, it's not A, she's not as she exists now because she's already changed so much stuff. I feel like it's more of a combo of B and C. I'm more in line with Rachel that I don't think that Dawn exists yet. And I think that the C part, because of all the changes that she's made and because she'll get a surprise twin in the future, it's going to erase the Nora as we knew her in season 5, and they're not going to be completely new kids because it's still going to be, like, Nora, but she'll just have, like, a completely different life, so it won't be, quote-unquote, Nora that we know, but it'll be, like, a different Nora.
Here's my question.
That's still JPK.
Do we think that they'll finally change her name, though, if she is not the Nora that we know?
No, I think she'll still be Nora, but we'll finally, like, her name is, like, Nora Dawn or whatever, because I don't think that, you know, spending all this time with her, that Barry and Iris would just, like, change her name. Like, she'd still be...
Yeah, exactly. That's the to change her name would be to suggest that she doesn't exist anymore. And that would not be the case. Also, I was going to say, the reason she, for the record, she thinks it's C, that there has to be serious repercussions to her time in the past, and having her go back to her time and having surprise her twin now is a bit cheap. That being said, Barry went back and spent a significant amount of time in the past, and he came back, and he's still himself. Like, yes, he is technically not the Barry that we knew, but he has all the memories of all the things. Mm-hmm. So I don't know why Nora wouldn't be able to have all the memories of all the things, even though everything is different when she comes back. I think they will do it. I think that that is what they'll do for the tears and for the, you know, drama. I just don't know why, because it didn't happen to Mary. And you would think that the one in control of the time travel gets to keep, you know, but only Mary does. So
anyway. I wonder if it's because it's such a massive change. This is like changing from the time that she was like, could remember things. Like, he's never been in her life. So if you're changing all the way back to, like, her beginning.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I guess we'll find out if they give us an explanation. Okay. But yes, I think she'll have a twin. I think she will be erased. Like, I think she'll be erased so that Barry and Iris can cry. And it's like, oh, she died. But then she's not dead because then Iris is pregnant. And then she's like, oh, I'm going to name her Nora. And you're like, oh, it's all fine. You know? She's back. Even though she's not back. You know? But it's... So it'll be like that. I don't think it'll be like all three things. And then if you were to check with Nora in the future, she would have the memories of it. But you're not going to check Nora in the future, so there you go. Anyway, so we got it. Thank you. We got a flash correspondent. The position is now filled again. Okay. Black Lightning, where are you? Okay. I'm done with all of this now. Except we have one last thing to talk about in this super long intro. And that is Stephen Amell. We got a couple asks about this, and we should talk about it anyway. Even if y'all hadn't asked about it, we would talk about it. So, Stephen Amell, JimHeath.tv wrote up this article about Stephen reversing his apology to Jennifer Watley. This happened back in 2015, mm-hmm. Over the, you know, the Ahmed and Texas clock bomb case. So at that time, he was upset about people stereotyping Texas and how that's not better than stereotyping Ahmed, which is obviously bullshit. And many people, he got backlash from many people, but Jennifer had actually made a Facebook video explaining to him why his comment was so hurtful and like what it was that he wasn't getting. And he apologized at that time and he said that I should have left it to smarter people. But,
it was actually a nice, long, thought-out apology, too. Yeah. So if you get a chance, it might be included in that Jim Heath article, but if you go back and you read, like, what he actually said back then, it kind of, you know, and then you know that he reversed all of that, just kind of makes it worse.
He said, pride gets in the way sometimes. Which, his reversal means that his pride got in the way. Sorry, I talked over you.
So, oh no, it's fine. You were just saying, like, he, you know, like, he's saying, it wasn't my intention, but I don't want to just say that it wasn't my intention. I do want to apologize. My pride got in the way, you know. So, and then he's like, and when people can't hear my tone of voice, and in social media, it's very easy to not come across correctly and for others to feel disrespected. I should be more aware of my large audience, etc. So he gave a very nice response. So I'm trying to see now it was in the Michael Rosenbaum Inside of You podcast, which is where he was asked about it. And then Amell said he did not regret saying what he said. He did not regret the, I regretted it in this situation that it devolved into someone leaving a link to a 20-minute video that they put on YouTube about how I couldn't possibly understand what it was like to live as a minority in the United States or in Canada or frankly anywhere because of who I am and what I do and the color of my skin. It was so far away from the original point. It was not what I was saying at all. I admire that person's courage to put themselves out there in a public forum, and I have no ill will towards them, but I apologize, and I regret apologizing more than I regret saying in the first place. That's ridiculous. I feel like that's, like, I don't like it, aside from the fact that he shouldn't regret apologizing, that's stupid, but more than that, it feels like he's denigrating what she did, right? Like, yeah. A lot of respect for doing that, like, but, like...
He's, like, lowering, like, because he doesn't even respond, call it by name, he, like, exaggerates how long the video is mm-hmm. to make her seem ridiculous. He doesn't call her by name, which he may be doing because he doesn't want to like draw attention to it, but it just seems very demeaning on top of the tone that I didn't want to apologize anyway. It just kind of leaves a bad taste all around.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, he also said that he thinks the teachers did the right thing, which mm-hmm. is insane.
Which is awful.
That's insane. I loved Jennifer's response, though. Jim Heath got TV, which I guess, like, at first I was like, why did they even write this up? But you know what, guys? Thanks. Thanks for doing that. They called her up. Like, they contacted her to get a comment. And her comment was, or her statement was, I don't have any comments on Stephen, though, other than to say I never think of him. And I'm no longer in the business of helping mediocre white men figure out how to be more considerate human beings. Which is the greatest response.
Yeah, it really is.
So...
I think it's just like really awful because it speaks to his constant idiocy when he tweets things, because he's done this several times. This is not like the first and it was not the last.
He tried to come after Beyonce.
Yeah,
and then
that.
Yep. The backlash.
Yeah. He was mad about that too.
And to like,
mad about
that. To like, you guys feelings about that one.
Yeah. And to like yep. degrade exactly. Jennifer, and then to say that the teachers were right in arresting a kid for what he didn't have, what was a bomb anyway, and then defending Texas, where he's not even from to begin with, is just like the height of white privilege, white male privilege. Like, it's just so arrogant and condescending.
And I didn't like listen to the podcast or whatever, so I don't even know how the topic came up. I don't know if he brought it up. I don't know if Michael Rosenbaum brought it up, but it's just like, how are you? Like, it had to be in his spirit for that long for him to come back and be, like, snapping his fingers. And another thing, I really didn't get it up.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, now that we've beaten that dead horse, shall we move on to the actual episodes?
Yes.
Take it away, May.
One second, I accidentally just X'd out.
Because it rhymes.
All right, one second. I accidentally X'd out and I had to go back. I am your host, May. That doesn't rhyme, but I'm your host anyway. Side A, Plan S.
That rhymed.
Plan S/Ghost Initiative. We'll be talking about Supergirl and Arrow, and then Side B, we'll be discussing Flash and Black Lightning. To recap Supergirl, the episode was called Suspicious Minds. Colonel Haley is upset after Supergirl responds to a distress call from a Navy ship that turned out to be a deadly alien attack. Colonel Haley reclaims the site as DEO territory and demands that Supergirl step aside. After Supergirl refuses to be told what to do, Haley refocuses her energy on finding out Supergirl's true identity and begins to interrogate all DEO agents, including Alex and the randos who suddenly know who, who she is. All right. So what did you ladies think? What did you ladies like about the episode first? And foremost.
All right. Well, I was glad that we finally got a story about human-alien relations that focused on the atrocities committed by the oppressors and framed the retaliation by the victims as exactly that, retaliation by victims. So I liked that Kara and Alex and John were, like, understanding of what Moray went through, and they called the government on its BS, which I felt like it finally found a little bit of nuance. Chang has a point, though, that we can talk about the dislikes. But for in terms of, like, the government and humans are doing bad things to these aliens, and these aliens are only acting out because of the trauma that they experienced, I like that. It was also the first time in a while that I felt like Kara was, like, in on the action and helping to drive the story.
Uh-huh.
And her relationship with Alex was front and center. Their emotional bond was the gut punch at the end of the episode, and it worked. Although there are parts of it that did not work, but that scene and that moment worked. The performances were on point. So, yeah, that's, you know, it felt like Kara's show for the first time in a while. I did enjoy the season between James and Lena. Like, I don't believe they haven't talked to each other since Thanksgiving. That's just, you know, sloppy writing, whatever. But I thought that it was nice that James maturely evaluated his actions, he owned up to his side of responsibility, and then he threw his full support behind Lena, because now he's decided that it's hypocritical to have opposite opinions. But in the future, that will be good. But now, that is, you know, I was like, that's nice. I'm glad we worked that out. Alright. Finally, I was instructed to say my brainy and Neo-like so that Jessica could knock them down and tear them apart. So I will say that I loved everything that Brainy did this episode. I love how he wants to help Kara, but he's not, like, entirely sure how things work on Earth, I guess, or, like, in the present, I don't know, with humans. Because, like, it was really cute and funny that he wanted to pay John to help Kara, but it also goes to show that he doesn't, like, friendship is still a foreign concept to him. Like, whatever time he spent with the Legion, does not erase however he was raised. Because, like, who would think, like, I'm going to pay my friend to help our mutual friend, like, you know, that's not friendship. Anyway, so I was like, oh, this is, like, I have feelings about this. Anyway, I like that he admitted that he didn't think Nia would want to date him. So I'm looking forward to seeing if they pick up that thread or not. Like, I do think that Nia, you know, pushed it aside because she was embarrassed, and because obviously she's expressed interest before. So I doubt that that non-date made her suddenly reevaluate that she, whether or not she wanted to see him. She just was like, oh, I don't think he likes me. But I'll be fine with either way, like, whatever way they want to go, as long as they don't have Nia pining without reciprocation. Because that's just awkward. Like, it doesn't make me enjoy, you know, if they were to go the brainy Kara route, then Nia pining would just be sad. So
yeah, I don't think they'll do that. If it does happen that way, I don't think it will have her looking like sad puppy off to the side. I don't think they'll do that one.
Right. Furthermore, I love that he's the one that's pushing her to step into her heroism. But they, you know, they have these shared experiences that at very least strengthen their bond as friends and as partners on the field. So there we go.
Yeah, I mean, we talked last week about how we'd finally know how Brainy's feeling about Nia, and we have our answer, I think. And I thought their dinner date scene was cute, and I love their interactions with each other. Brainy actually took the time and came up with ideas for Nia's suit, and that was really sweet and says a lot. And I like that we saw a little bit of his feelings and that he essentially thought she was too good for him, basically. So she was trying to act nonchalant about it afterwards. But since the writers seemed on the fence before, I think it's safe to say that the ship will most likely sail at this point for me, because even if there is evidence that Brainy could end up with Kara, maybe. Like, the way that he goes hard for her, he wants people to support her and back her up and whatever. But his interactions have been primarily with Nia face-to-face. Nia was also very much not against the date with Brainy, and he admitted that she's beautiful and believes in her as a hero. So the story writes itself.
Well, ladies and gentlemen of the podcast jury... Like, last week, we said we'd finally get the answer to where the writers are going with either, like, Brainy and Nia, if they're going to push that ship, or if they're slowly still leaving it open for Brainy and Kara. And the prosecution has laid out their cases as to why they believe that it's on the Brainy side of the fence. And there's some strong evidence there. You know, Brainy thinks that, obviously, that Nia's attractive, and he really thought that she was too beautiful to ever want to date someone like him. So there's strong evidence. However, I still think that my side of the fence looks pretty good. And I'm going to tell you why. Because Brainy's primary focus this entire episode, really, and for a meeting with Nia, was to talk about Kara. And if we back up to the beginning of the episode, when you have Haley, Alex, and Brainy meet Kara on the boat, and Haley and Kara start going at it a little bit, and Alex and Brainy try to defend her afterwards, that's when Brainy goes to John. He's like, Supergirl really needs some backup. I'm willing to pay you to be her backup, which was a really nice kind of funny scene. And John promising to be there for Kara, but not taking his money. So I guess, like, Brainy was like, well, this isn't as enthusiastic of a promise to help Kara as I wanted. But so, like, and then, like, even as the episode progresses, at the DEO, he's really super concerned about, like, Haley's Spanish inquisition of all the agents to find Kara's identity. And, like, again, when he's talking to Alex, he's like, I'm really worried about Kara and her not having any kind of support in the field. And then we get him randomly asking Nia to go eat food in a public place where other people of similar interests also eat food publicly. And, like, his whole purpose, like, she thought it was a date, but his whole purpose for meeting her, even after they established that, oh, I thought this was a date. Oh, no, I'm sorry. This is a little bit awkward. But anyway, about Supergirl. So, like, that was kind of his main focus for wanting to talk to Nia, because he wanted her to be, like, a super friend for Kara. So, like, this whole episode, Brainy has been trying to set up a support system for Kara. And it's not, like, the first time that we've seen him be really overly concerned or protective of Kara in situations. Like, for example, when he was trying to lead her in the Luther Court when she couldn't really transform in front of Lena. And I think he had like a moment of unsurety where he was like concerned, like he didn't know like which way to go. And afterwards he was really upset with himself because it could have cost Kara, you know, and he could have caused injury to Kara because he couldn't tell her which way to go. So those kind of things. And like when she goes into a coma and he's really concerned about her and her mind palace and everything like that. So I feel like while if nothing else, we can all agree that Brainy is a man of taste and we stand a man of taste. I think there's still wiggle room or open to interpretation of where the writers want to go. I think the next move is obviously going to be on Nia to push the ship. I enjoyed their not date and Brainy using his history of how he resisted the idea of being a hero at first to connect to her. And I agree that she tried to play off her embarrassment with like nonchalance, but seeing as how Brainy is like super literal, I don't know if he took it as well, I guess that she's not and he won't do anything. So for me, I think in the next few episodes, if he invites her to an escape room or to paintball, that would be like a definitive thing that he's showing interest with intention to date her. Or, and the way I think it would have to go is Nia would have to do like the Sadie Hawkins thing because now she knows he finds her attractive and she knows his idea of a date. So if this ship were to lift off, then I think she would need to, you know, be very clear and invite him to paintball or something to get him to be like, oh, so you do like me kind of thing. So the defense rests. That's my little rebuttal. But other things did happen in this episode. I agree with Tati, like the history of the Moray in this episode was the first time in a while that I think the show is focused on the story through the POV of the victims. The Moray and Haley's part in it is one of the better storylines I think Supergirl's pulled off, that little nuanced balance. I think Haley is super complicated as a character, but there's a lot about her portrayal, or rather the more so the character's reactions to her, that I think is better explained for me in the dislikes, so I'll leave that there. I loved Supercore's Soul Cycle. I thought it was really nice. It's long overdue for Kara and Lena to have some kind of time together. And it's that slice of daily life that I think that Supergirl does really well and other DC TV shows never do as good a job as incorporating. Like in all the other shows, everyone just, they only exist at the workplace or in the field. And Supergirl does put in those little, you know, going out to eat with your friends or, you know, sleepover with your girlfriends, all these little daily life things that I really like to see more of in general. Like seeing John and Kara working together. Although when I saw that he had all of his records that he kept while he was in the DEO, I was like, Marie Kondo would not think this sparks joy. This is crack reddish. So that's a plot. And then I finally, like, with James and Lena, I like that we got a real apology from James to Lena, not only for getting upset when she protected him, but also for just being a hypocrite in general. It seemed like we were getting glimpses of the real James again. So I am not as shrug emoji as Shang is. I think that it was a good turnaround for James, who has had like a lot of ills recently. So
I like Brainy and all things having to do with Brainy, and I just find something so endearing and compelling about Jesse Rath's portrayal of him. Like, he's a fish out of water, but also a deeply gentle and caring person. And I love how passionate he was about helping Kara, and then he even went to Jean for help. That was super cute. And then his super friend reference was really funny, and I had a good chuckle because he doesn't even know what he did there. I found myself liking the plot a lot. More than I thought I would, because it was a good way to point out how the government has turned its back on aliens who were forced to work for them and what kind of a betrayal that was. So it wasn't about aliens hurting people so much as the ways the government itself is just as predatory as they're making the aliens out to be. And the Moray were hurt, abused, and raised to be weapons, so it wasn't hard to understand why they wanted revenge. And I thought the threat level for finding out Kara's identity was high, and by the time it got to the end, I admit I was really emotional having to watch Kara and Alex discuss Alex's memory wiping of Kara being Supergirl. And Melissa and Kyler really delivered in their emotional scenes together. And I like the reference to Elseworlds, since it wasn't that long ago Alex didn't know who she was. And I think it's been, like, the best Elseworlds reference, whereas The Flash was the worst.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that scene was, like, really a gut punch. And then the plot had a personal touch to it, and it was good at introducing the Moray into the show. And I, side note, John's new job really suits him. And I love that we saw Kara and Lena taking a spin class, like just said. It felt like 84 years since we've seen the two of them together on screen, and I've missed their friendship, so it was nice to see them hanging out. And finally, I'm not exactly sure how to feel about James and Lena, but I did like that they both at least apologized to each other, even if James wasn't able to see her perspective until he was in her shoes. But they were honest with each other, and I like that Lena decided to tell him about her experiments so that they're at least back on the same page, which I didn't expect would happen at all.
I forgot about my most important, like, which was that Alex and Kara, like, final scene with the whole, like, gut punch of her having to erase her memories. And I agree with you. That was a really angsty and really emotional scene. So they delivered that really well.
What did we not like about the episode?
What did I not like about this episode? Well, Shang is right that it's kind of, you know, like, annoying, awkward, you know, bad optics, whatever you want to call it, that, like, the black woman that they introduced to the cast, right? Like, really the only major woman of color this season or any season, because it's Supergirl, is the one that's, like, against, you know, even though she's on the quote-unquote good side, she's, like, on our side, but she's the one that's, like, the most bigoted. I would say, you know, aside from the actual literal villain. So yes, like that's not great. But aside from that, the DEO plot was just like a bit too convenient. Like it was just there to lead us to the Alex mind wipe. Like I don't know why that many people who we've never seen before would even know who Kara is. Like whether or not they're relevant or like they're cool, they're all like besties and we never hang out with them. Like what's the point of a secret identity if everyone at your work knows who you are, right? In that case, why couldn't Supergirl just tell the president who she is if she already told all these randos? It doesn't make sense. Like, she doesn't, like, Lena doesn't get to know, but the random DEO workers do? It's just, no, it doesn't, it's stupid. I don't know why they know. Anyway, and then, like, the fact that they had that girl, specifically the girl who was like, we'll use our anti-interrogation techniques or our interrogation resistance techniques to ward them off. Oh, I actually didn't study that much of my anti-interrogation techniques, sorry.
I feel that.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what? Okay. That was awkward. Hello, incompetence. Just talking about that. But anyway, while I really liked the Moray part of the story, I thought that the investigation in the car was just a little tedious. Like, Supergirl is super powerful. So, even if they threaten to do something to her, or, like, her sister, or, like, to reveal her identity, can't she just threaten to, like, punch them into the center of the earth? I don't know. Like, maybe they'll be like, I'm gonna call that bluff. But are they gonna call that bluff? Because, like I said, she's super powerful. She was like, and I'll call my cousin Superman, because for some reason, everyone knows that we're cousins, just like Clark and I are cousins. I don't know why this specifically was revealed to the universe. But, anyway, I just don't buy that threat, because, again, Supergirl can just do whatever she wants to them, and they would not be able to stop her, unless they had a lot of kryptonite, which she could take from them before they decide to use it. All right. Moving on, I'm very tired of Soviet Supergirl and her, like, one scene in an episode that does not tell us anything. Like, eventually, she will matter. One day, she will be controlled and bad things will happen with her. And I'm like, okay, you couldn't have just, like, brought her in when those things were going to happen? Because, like, nothing is developing with her. They just have her there, training randomly topic. Inserted. Yeah, clearly.
Training.
And we didn't know that already.
So, yeah.
There you go. That's my dislikes.
I definitely agree with you. Like, if the writers hadn't created randos who know Supergirl's identity, John wouldn't have had to mind wipe anybody but Alex. And it just seems dumb that only those five random people know and not the whole DEO. Like, what? Like, how are they special that they found out? Like, did they walk in on her when she was, like, changing or something? Like, I don't know what the deal is, but why just those five? But my whole thing about Haley, and I know, like, Shang is just, like, fed up, and there's a lot of issues. I think she's very complicated. She's an antagonist. She's not a villain. Like I said when Anon asked where we would sort Haley in Hogwarts, I said she's basically Umbridge without the racism. Because I don't think that she I don't think she hates all aliens. I think she does have some prejudices based on ignorance and how, like, she, with the military and the training in the military that she received, I think that she views, you know, as long as they're law-abiding citizens, then she doesn't have a problem. But I do think that she is more prejudiced towards non-humanoid aliens. Like, she sees them more as animals instead of as, like, sentient beings like her. But she is an antagonist, and I think she has the same goals as the heroes of protecting all the citizens of the United States, but her methods are drastically different than what Kara and Alex want to do. So she's basically like the internal counterpart to Manchester Black, who's the external antagonist. Like, he's doing stuff out there. He's on the same side, but his methods are drastically different from Kara's. Haley is that, but internally and primarily for Alex. Like I said, I think that her ignorance in her regards to her views on aliens mainly stems from her training in the military and how things she thinks are supposed to work. Especially with non-humanoid aliens being like animals and being domesticated, because that's how she treated the Moray. It's like, you have a wild horse, you break the horse does what you want. And that's how she has been trained to think of these aliens. I actually think that she treated Kara and other humanoid aliens in general differently because they look like her. And she didn't really start to focus in on, like, finding information to, quote-unquote, break Kara until Kara stops, like, fully cooperating with her. And she also treats her human people that way, her human resources, the same way as, this is the military, you do what I say. Like, she's very controlling. And that's just how she, like, order and control is how she works. But basically, she needs an education that all aliens, regardless of their appearance, whether they're humanoid or not, deserve to be treated with the same respect that she would treat, you know, another human being. So, like, all of that is, like, very complicated. And I think I remember in one of the interviews that they were doing about the episodes, and one that concerned Haley in particular, is, I forgot which writer it was, but they were saying that they were going to start unpacking that for Haley. So it is something that she is going to have an arc of starting at this one extreme and slowly revealing and coming out of it and growing from it. But what particularly bothered me in this episode is that there's this sense of putting her on the same level as Agent Liberty. Like, there's just all this, like, righteous indignation from Carr and Alex thrown at her that I don't think we ever really see toward Lockwood and Agent Liberty and the Children of Liberty. There's always, like, hand-holding with them. But especially in this episode, you know, everybody was whining. It's not just, like, Carr and Alex. Everybody was just, like, whining the whole episode. They were calling Haley a monster, no morality, which I thought was a big stream. Haley's whining to Alex about Kara. Kara and Alex are whining to Haley. And it's just, like, everything just got really very annoying to me. I didn't like Alex punching Haley. I know it's supposed to be, like, a good, like, whew, you know, one for the good guys kind of thing. But I'm just not going to be the one that's like, oh, yay, violence against a black woman. Unless she's, like, an assassin actively trying to kill you. Like, if there's violence against a black woman, I'm probably not going to like it. There's just all of this. People are talking around each other, not talking to each other, that I didn't like. And I feel like if they all got their heads out of their asses, then they would really realize that they could work well together. So, yeah.
I've always had problems with mind wiping because it's such a slippery slope morally, and I wish the writers could have had John wipe all the agents' minds with consent before Haley found out about Kara and before doing it to her. But alas. But at least they acknowledged John had a problem with it, which is better than him doing it and thinking it was okay without question. And obviously my nitpick was also that we're only now meeting these unnamed agents who seemingly out of nowhere know Kara's identity. And actually, I'm going to backtrack because Tati mentioned about kryptonite, which I think if Haley, like, could have used resources, she would have gotten kryptonite, locked Kara up in a room, and used that truth thing on her instead of bothering everybody else about it.
I feel like kryptonite would have been a better suppressant than I know who you are.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, at least she'd have something to back her up, because you're right, Kara could have just beaten her through a wall if she really wanted to. But back to the agents, like, why are we just now learning about them? And this makes me hate the keeping it a secret from Lena issue even more, which they generally seem to have dropped. And that's just frustrating in general. And then Red Daughter Supergirl made an appearance just so we wouldn't forget her existence, but then went nowhere with it once again. And I just wonder why they're stalling. Finally, I agree that I don't understand why Colonel Haley is being treated like enemy number one. It's like, where is this energy with when it comes to Agent Liberty? Is it because she seems to have a personal vendetta against Kara now? Because if that's the case, and I don't think it's a good look that they're just like so angry at her just because it involves Kara versus like all the other aliens that Agent Liberty is coming after.
Right.
All right. Moving into predictions. What do we think is going to happen in the upcoming episodes?
Well, I think that James is going to want to use Lena's cure. And bad things will happen to him because of it, and that is where Lex will come in with his friend's life hanging in the balance.
I think that's most likely. Like, either, yeah. I think he's definitely the friend that Lex is going to use against Lena, quote-unquote friend. And I think this may or may not be too early, but since they brought up the cure this episode, and next week Kara and Nia are visiting her family, and in the description, it says, Alex is dealing with, like, a drug that's giving humans temporary powers. And what does that sound like? That sounds like Lena's drug. So I think that this could be maybe, like, a prototype that she's been working on and someone steals it from her lab and mass produces it. And so it's out there in the world. And that would be, like, relevant to the conversation that she just had with James. And then I also had another one about Red Daughter. And I think that whenever she appears, that one will kind of be connected to Haley. Because Red Daughter is basically what Haley wants Kara to be. And seeing how, you know, this person raised in the military, this version of Kara raised in the military, all of that might be part of the key to Haley realizing that the whole military order regime forced conscription kind of thing isn't all it's cracked up to be, or like it might change her opinions on all of that.
Okay. My theory is just that Lena's cure could end up falling into either the government's hands or maybe the Children of Liberty's hands. And I feel like that would tie in with yours, Jess, about it being stolen and used. But maybe the Children of Liberty think that, like, then they'll finally be on even ground and they can fight the aliens.
Until it starts killing them or something.
Yeah. All right, moving into Arrow. To recap, the episode was called Shattered Lives. Oliver is ready to get back to work with SCPD and to focus on his marriage with Felicity. However, when Dinah tasks Oliver with tracking the new Green Arrow, things take a surprising turn, aka we discover that she is his half-sister. Meanwhile, Diggle and Lila must answer to Argus about Diaz and end up in another fight. What did we like about this episode?
Well, I really enjoyed the whole Emiko Queen aspect of the episode. It felt like a pilot episode for her. Like, if this was her own show and this was her pilot, that's what it felt like, which is really cool. She had her own list of names, her own vendetta. There's her own mystery in figuring out who killed her mom. She has her own murder board, so she and Mary will get along great. And so, like, I like the whole concept of the episode being, like, her pilot and having that pilot parallel Oliver's pilot episode. And I really love the development of her relationship with Renee. Renemiko, or Wild Queen, I don't know which one I want to go with yet, but I like them together. I like how she goes from this place of always being alone and being used to being alone and solitary and not letting anyone in to slowly, over the course of the episode, letting him and eventually others like Curtis into her world. I like that Renee was a little bit stubborn and persistent and wanting to help her and trying to convince her that she can do it alone. And whether she wants to admit it or not, but the fact that she goes to Renee instead of the hospital when she gets shot and trusts him to help her really speaks to how much she kind of intrinsically trusted him all along. Like, he's been helping her all this time, So when she gets help, shot and she needs help, he's the first person that she thinks of. And she actually unmasks herself for him, or in front of him, not for him, but you know what I mean. And that, even more than that, I like that Zoe, of all people, was the one encouraging Renee to go help her. It's like William had a fit when he found out Oliver was a Green Arrow, and Zoe's like practically handing her father his mask and his gun, like pushing him out the door, like, go! break the law, Dad. So I like Zoe's enthusiasm towards like the whole vigilantes, and it's on track with where she ends up in the future, so I thought that was really cool. And an episode that parallels back to the pilot of the show, I like that there's callbacks to Walter Steele and Moira. I thought those were like really nice touches to kind of remind you like where the show came from with Oliver. And then the flash forwards are definitely more interesting now than they were in the beginning of the season. And at times I feel like I'd rather see what's going on there instead of staying in the present. So, yeah.
That's not incorrect. I really enjoyed the purposeful parallels to Oliver's first season storyline. I liked Emma as a character. I liked her backstory. I mean, like, it was sad, but I liked how they revealed that backstory and how she was telling it to Renee as Oliver and Felicity were figuring out the connection for themselves. That was, like, a cool intersection, if you will. And it definitely made me sympathize with her. I love her tender partnership with Renee. And how, you know, he just really wanted to be needed by someone. Like, he wanted to go out there and make a change and have, you know, have partners again, basically. Because he's just lonely. Just him and Zoe. Anyway, I thought that Oliver and Felicity were cute together this episode. I think it's been a while since I enjoyed their scenes, and I enjoyed those scenes, even though it was mostly just, like, plot, you know, let's move forward and figure out who this sister is. Speaking of which, I squealed when they mentioned Walter. I was like, oh my god! We remember that he exists! He was so wonderful! Oh, I was so upset when he left. Even though Some Girls was an excellent show, and it's totally acceptable that he went to go be the dad in that show. But anyway, I like the connective tissue back to season one. And of course the Moira thing too, even though, you know, constantly disrespecting Moira even in death. But that's fine. I was really into the flash forwards, as well. Future Zina, future Zoe are badass, and I'm intrigued by what could have led Renee down the path that he's on, because I don't think that this is usual for him. I don't think this is like, ah, you know, of course Renee would do this. I also wonder how committed he is to Sparkle Motion, because I felt that he seemed swayed by Dinah in their scene together, which of course was as fire crackly as ever. And I also felt that he seemed unnerved by Felicity's fate, even if he covered it up. So, I thought Rick did a great job with those scenes, and I'm, you know, wig aside. And I'm looking forward to more of that story.
Yay! For me, the flash forwards, yes, I have changed my mind. I am liking them now. I take back everything I said. I like that they're slowly starting to reveal what happened to the Glades and Renee's reveal as mayor and how everything is kind of tying together. And I legit thought that Zoe hadn't been on speaking terms with her father for years, only it turned out to be 3 days. And so it was nice to know that they still talk, even though they had their differences, because I'd hate to see them not speaking to each other for that long of a time. And I like that we saw how not everyone is on board with Oliver working with the SCPD, and how not everyone is okay with the vigilantes in general, and also that the secret identity of Emiko wasn't hidden from Oliver for too long. I mean, I thought the CSI for the SCPD was like being a little bit melodramatic, but it got the point across. In regards to Emiko, it gave him time to process the fact that he had another sister, and also got him to reanalyze everything he'd come to know about his father, which was like a tough thing to do knowing he started off as being Green Arrow because of his dad. So that was a little bit sad to watch. And I think Emiko is a great addition to the show, and she already has like so much depth to her. It's crazy that she's been living in Star City right under Oliver's nose this whole time and he didn't know. But I like that she has her own mission and that she trusted Renee enough to help her out. And I was really sad for her when she realized the man she was after was not who killed her mom. But I like that she has fire and energy and drive. And this episode just made me want to know more about her. So I could totally buy a spinoff series with her. I think that would be really exciting if they ever decide to kill off Oliver Queen in a crossover.
Yeah.
But what do we not like about this episode?
Okay,
what
so
we not like?
Yeah. I like thank you, Tasha, for reminding me that Oliver's limited presence in 710 was because Stephen was filling the Elseworlds crossover. Like Grant was limited in 710 because of the Elseworlds crossover, or not 710, but his 510. So thank you for reminding me of that, because the lack of movement in storyline like really, really frustrated me. It wasn't like The Flash, where I didn't even mind or really notice Barry at all, or his reduced presence. Like, he didn't really have a storyline, so I didn't really care that he wasn't in it as much. But in Arrow, they actually gave Oliver a story, a good one, and then they wouldn't let him do anything with it. So I'm like, why are you still, you know, standing around the apartment when you just found out you had a sister? And then since they paired Felicity with Oliver and had those scenes be Felicity scenes, and since Oliver's not moving, she's not moving, so she also suffers from reduced screen time where she could have been used elsewhere in the episode. She's just, like, stuck babysitting Steven in his limited scenes because he can't go anywhere if he has to film another show, or another episode. So when they confirmed, like, Emiko was his sister, like, he should have gone to see her and not, like, I felt like he should have gone to see her and not cry about it for 30 minutes and wait until the end of the episode. Like, I don't, yeah. It just didn't really seem like it would make that much sense to me. It's not like they didn't need to go look up accounts and find evidence that Robert had been supporting Emiko and her mother. Like, the story wasn't, this woman is claiming to be your sister, Oliver, how do we prove this, you know, kind of thing. They literally proved it in the first scene with DNA. So I don't know why they had to go and find more evidence to tell them something that they already knew. They could have at least attempted to try to locate her or something, or seem more proactive rather than reflective. They were really emotional scenes, and, you know, I feel like Steven saved up all those tears he'd had in Bang for the last, like, 6 years of Arrow and, like, really put them into this, like, one scene that he had. And so it came off really emotional, but, you know, it was emotional for every time we cut back to them for their whole 10 minutes of screen time. And so, like, it doesn't move. And I would rather, you know, you cry and then you do something. You don't wait till the end of the episode to do something. So, like, the fact that his story didn't really move anywhere is kind of frustrating. Did not like Renee's wig. You know, CW struggle wig legacy lives on. I don't know why he needed all that hair. To make him look more worthy or whatever, I don't know. The whole divide between Zoe and Dinah versus Renee feels a bit forced to me. I know Tasha doesn't like Renee, so it's easy for her to see, like, that he is shady and did some shit. And I don't know if maybe all the plot points aren't aligning for me just yet in the future, but there just have to be, for me, like, some kind of drastic event for him to go from kind of the heart of the present episode with his desire to help the new Green Arrow to continue to fight the good fight and save the city to being basically the antagonist of the future. It just doesn't seem realistic to me yet where that shift came. And then finally Diggle undermining Lila and coming up with his own deal and then basically telling her you're welcome when it happens to work out also really annoyed me. So, yeah, like, Diggle was trying to do Lila's job better than Lila, and I don't know if that's, I don't think that he thought that he was doing that, but that's really kind of what was happening, and I don't understand, like, why the writers really prefer writing dysfunctional couples, like, who hurt you, I don't know, but I'm just kind of tired of seeing the same kind of cycle of mistrust and miscommunication between Dyla, so.
Boo, Dyla! Yeah, okay, so I don't see how Renee in the future seems like a possibility right now. So I guess what I don't like about that plot is that it means fandom is going to shit on him until and then even after whatever explanation for how he got here. So it bothers me when he especially gets put in the position to be, you know, like an antagonist to fandom. So he's like, Laurel. Anyway. however, I am confident that things are not as they appear, so I'm just gonna wait it out, basically. Also, yeah, Diggle and Lila was just super annoying to me on many levels. I don't want another Suicide Squad. I don't need another Suicide Squad. And how come Diggle gets to bitch Lila out for Suicide Squad, and then he's like, Suicide Squad 2.0, but with shittier characters? So, yeah. He came off as arrogant. He was disrespectful to his wife. And I just hate Diaz, and I just don't want to see him do anything ever. So I don't like that we have to see that. And I also agree that, like, Felicity chilling with Oliver, when she could have been doing more productive things, was, you know, kind of a waste of her talents. She could have been put on a different storyline. And I don't know. I guess
it's a storyline, because that's the only time that Curtis appeared, and they obviously don't care about him, so.
I forgot that Curtis appeared, but yes.
Yeah.
Poor Curtis.
So did they. In the future. So did
yes. But yeah, I don't know. I feel like, you know, I'd like to see her form a bond with Emiko, or I just, the one thing I don't like about the flash forwards is the amount of time we're spending thinking Felicity is dead, because I don't think she can be dead. So I just want to know where she was going with this. And also, like, it's been a really long, you know, dragging out of, like, oh, Felicity was going to bomb the city, and then Felicity was not going to bomb the city. And I was like, okay, this sounds fake anyway. But yeah, so I would like them to get going on that side of it. And if she's dead, if she is dead in the future, then come on, let her do some more in the present, right? Before yeah. she has to go out.
Yeah.
But anyway, that reminds me, though, that Diggle pulling Diaz into the Ghost Initiative is kind of a slap in the face of Felicity, too. Like, it's like, oh, all that work for Felicity to be able to feel at peace, right? And get Diggle get Diaz out of the way. But no, just kidding. We're gonna bring him out so that he can help us fight crime every once in a while. So, I don't like that. That's all.
Yeah, I agree with that. Diaz. Anyway, first I'm going to start Diggle and Lila, who are once again at odds, and I'm tired of them having similar conversations over and over again. And I think it's hypocritical of Diggle to judge Lila for having been involved in the Suicide Squad, like you guys already said, only for him to turn around and create one of his own just to get Diaz on board with cooperating. So, like, they always seem to be on opposing sides, and it's really exhausting because it's always the same things. Lack of communication, accusations, and lies between them. So, like, for once, I'd like to go one season without them fighting, especially given Lila's limited presence on the show. So, like, this plotline makes Diggle look much harsher about these kinds of things than he usually is, and it's irritating that it's primarily because of plot convenience than it is for actual character development. And as much as I dislike Diaz, I'm now annoyed that they've upped him to series regular, only for him to not be the primary big bad anymore. Like, just let him go. Completely. I know we were supposed to buy that Renee is this hardened politician looking out for the Glades and the Glades only in the future, but I also don't buy quite yet, because it's Renee, and I don't think he would go so out of bounds like this and not want to help. So there must be more to the story. And finally, it seems Felicity also suffered a similar fate of being sidelined following the crossover like Iris did in 510. So they relegated her scenes to mostly being with Oliver, which is fine if I trusted the writers to actually care about giving her anything else, which I don't. And it seems like after she and Oliver made up and she was no longer so aggressively after Diaz, that her storyline is vanishing now that Oliver is back from prison. Whew. Moving into predictions. What do we think is going to happen?
Yeah, let's do Tasha's because we're all just going to agree with her. So, Tasha says that 2040 Renee is going to start to question his choices to redeem himself. Yes. The Archer program they mentioned in the flash forward was created by Felicity. It ties into the DNA organization security system. And that is part of their apartment in the present. Yes. Curtis is totally going to die. He hasn't had much of a storyline in season 5. He wasn't mentioned when they listed the Mark of 4. Absolutely, yes.
That was
and
hilarious.
Dante, yes, Dante is, the Dante person Dial is investigating is the same one as the one in the comics who runs the Ninth Circle. He is the one who murdered Emiko's mom, and that's how the story will tie together. I love that.
Yeah, that's my favorite one, I think. I think that is absolutely right. And then, as far as, like, Renee, and I do agree that he's going to redeem himself because of that final scene with the guy, like, questioning, did you actually kill her? So obviously, Renee is not going to be an antagonist to Dinah and Zoe for long. But, like, I was thinking, if Renee is in on this plot to bomb Star City, and Felicity was in on the plot to bomb Star City, because she drew up the plans, doesn't that mean that they were working together or at least aware of each other in the future?
Yeah. So, like, I think, yeah. He's like a triple agent. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, there's this kind of, like, you know, oh, Felicity went bad in the future. Well, she went bad with Renee. And so if Felicity is not really the bad guy that people think that she is, then it's possible that Renee is also not the bad guy that everyone thinks that he is. And would be kind of why, you know, when he figures out from this dude that she's supposedly dead, that he's like, oh, shit, now I have to, like, do something. So...
Yep.
Can I also say that 100%. I realized these flash forwards never included William, which I didn't even notice. but yes, I agree with Tasha's prediction about Curtis potentially being a goner by the end of the season. And also, if Renee is not in with Felicity, then I do think he's some sort of pawn to like that partner guy in his office because he looked a little bit too smug for my liking. So there's something shady going on there.
White men usually do. Usually do look smug.
All right. Side A, Lady with Gumption nominations. Who do we vote for?
Cara?
Who do we vote for? Yeah, Cara has some gumption. Alex has some gumption. I feel like... Emma Cara has some gumption. Like,
huh?
Oh yeah!
Oh, yeah, she's another good one. I think like she's clearly the nominee for Arrow. Or I would do like another if we're doing two and two, then I would throw in Zoe as well because she had gumption to tell her dad to like push him to join with Emiko, and then in the future with her going to like approach him and try and you know get him to be on the good side, that kind of thing. So I would say that she's a good, strong candidate. I think Alex and Carr both had gumption, but I just didn't like Alex punching Haley. I don't like that whole dynamic, so yeah. I don't give it to her for that. Like, I don't want to reward that.
Yeah. I would agree. So Kara and Alex, no, sorry, Kara and Emiko and Zoe for side A.
Yes.
Okay. Beautiful.
All right.
Moving into side B, Saving Grace / Ready or Not. On the Flash, seeing red, even though that didn't really happen. We saw more red than Barry saw red. During a battle with Cicada, Nora is severely injured, and due to Cicada's dampening powers, Nora's speed healing isn't working. So Barry and Iris are scared for their daughter's future, while an enraged Flash confronts Cicada in a brutal battle. And I feel like part of the synopsis was missing, because over in the B-plot, we had Killer Frost... bitching to Caitlin the entire time about how she didn't want this cure and destroying shit. And then Ralph had to talk her down. And that's what you missed on The Flash. So what did we like?
I mean, I like when it ended. the only things that I think I liked about this episode were like the character highlights. And there's only one interesting storyline. But firstly, like, Cecile, she had a fantastic episode. She's a character highlight for me. She and her powers were utilized very well throughout, I thought. And to be honest, I think she was utilized even for this episode, even more than Joe would have been if he would have been available. And I think that's because she's, maybe it's because she's a meta. I don't know. Some of the aspects of her storyline, I think, could have included Iris or Iris could have done. But I like that Cecile was the connecting point for the CCPD storyline, since she has more reason to be there and push for things with Sing as opposed to maybe Iris being the one to like ask or push for it. Cecile's a little bit more authority as a prosecutor and professional equal with Sing, so that was fine. Speaking of Iris, she also had some really standout scenes, so she's another character highlight for me in the limited time that she did have, and those are mostly with Nora, who is another character highlight. So, like, the bedside scene with Nora waking up to find that she is paralyzed, and I thought that was really well acted between Candace and Jessica Parker Kennedy with the whole, you know, Nora, like, finding out that she's hurt and, like, reaching out for her mom instinctively calling out for her mom and, like, wanting to know, like, what's wrong, what could happen to her. Because usually, like, all kids do that when they're hurt. They call for their mom. So I like that Nora is, you still kind of see that she's still, like, a kid, and she, when she's hurt, she wants her mom. I also like that Iris, when she finds Sherlock interrogating Nora, pretty much, she goes into full, like, mama bear mode and telling him to, like, back off. And we talked about this a little bit before we started recording, but Tati thinks that maybe Sherlock did tell Iris about the journal back in the 509, the 100th episode, and they just cut that scene. And I think that would have been more sense if we had seen that scene in 509. Her approach to Sherlock in this episode would have made a lot more sense, because I thought it was weird that, or I thought it could have been better if we had seen the buildup over the course of the episode of, like, Sherlock acting strangely and Iris noticing, like, little things and, like, finally putting it together when she catches him, like, asking her questions. That would have been good. And also, if we had that cutscene from 509, that would have also tied it a little bit more cleanly together. But just Iris being so protective of her daughter and being like, you need to back down, I thought was really well acted. So it's like, and that plot, the whole Sherlock investigating Nora plot, was oddly like the most interesting plot of the episode. So it's like really crazy that Sherlock is the highlight of an episode plot, but here we are. I don't know. And then finally, my final character highlight is Ralph for his babysitting Caitlin and Killer Frost through their conflict. And his belief in Norvok being a decent person, actually leading to Norvok being a decent person. So I thought he was utilized very well as kind of like a mediator person. But basically, it's like everybody, I enjoyed everyone except for Barry and Caitlin and Skeeta. So that's, and those, and they were the main part of the episode. So there you go.
So for me, Cecile was the hero of the episode. I appreciated that the show finally is putting her job to good use this season, where, you know, we're seeing how she can help get things done. And her powers feel a lot less clunky now that she's an empath rather than a literal mind reader. I also liked that we got some nuance with Sing. Just like at first, he was reluctant to admit that the leak could be coming from his precinct, because, you know, that's bad publicity for CCPD. But then as soon as the culprit was uncovered, he didn't go soft on him. He was actually, you know, he stood his ground and he sided with Cecile very easily. So yeah, I really enjoyed the two of them. I also thought that Jonesy was a nice callback to 504. I liked that Cecile and Sing acknowledged his grievance, but declared that all citizens deserve protection, meta or otherwise. So it was like a nice little, like, mini version of the Supergirl storyline that's been going on all season.
And I was going to mention that as well, but as one of my likes, I think they are doing it or hitting it, because it's a similar theme between The Flash and Supergirl as far as, you know, eliminating one entire race of beings. And I think that The Flash hits at it a little bit better because they're not, like, so preachy about it. And right. They... like, the bad people, like, I understand, but this is still a bad thing. It, that comes across better in The Flash than what Supergirl's been trying to do.
Yeah. Like, they're like, I feel you, but you're crazy. All right. So, Candace acted her ass off with the scenes that she got. Even though she was sidelined, but she really worked, like, every moment that she was on screen. Her worry for Nora was palpable. Her fierceness in any of Sherlock was great. I just, like, the amount of vulnerability and then rage that she can just, like, display from one second to the next, that she really runs the gamut of emotions. Yeah. So she's, like, she's always improving. I love her. She's great. Amazing. That's all. And then I really liked that little, like, final scene with Iris, Nora, and Barry. I thought it was, first it was, like, really sweet, like, when Barry said that they loved her. Like, they're like, oh, you know, we love you. And, like, you see, like, how moved Nora is to hear her father say he loves her, like, because it's not something that she heard when she was grown up, because he was dead. And we also get, like, you know, Barry talking to Iris about how he, like, kind of understands what it means to be a dad. And I thought he was really, like, that was, like, a really soft moment. Like, I was like, we'll talk about the dislikes in terms of Grant's performance and the writing for Barry this episode. But in that scene, I was like, yes, this is Barry. This is a Barry scene. I feel this. So yeah. Safina is garbage, but I like that Dr. Ambrose is like the force behind him. Sort of like, you know, the woman behind the throne or whatever. Like, she's kind of like pushing him to get things done. It's kind of like an interesting reversal from the mechanic and thinker of last season. So I'm intrigued. And like, even though, you know, again, I don't care about Cicada, but I'm like, oh, Dr. Ambrose can step up. Let's see her use the dagger. Anyway, finally, I really love Ralph this episode. Like, he was like my runner up for like hero of the episode. If it wasn't Cecile, it would be Ralph.
How far you've come! Yay!
I know, right? But look how far he's come. Look how far he's true. Come.
My trash has come trash box. Yes.
A level headed sounding board for Caitlin and Killer Frost. Like, he was sympathized with Norvoke and also helped him access his inner hero. And he was actually a hero himself. You know, without hesitation. You know, was like, oh, well, we've got a problem. I'll stretch myself so y'all can get on board, right? I just, you know, he really needs a most improved award. That's from 2018 to 2019. That was, like, the biggest level up of all time. So.
Beautiful. because I like some angst. I enjoyed watching Barry and Iris worry about and be protective of Nora following her injury. And it's sad that she had to get injured for them to have family scenes together, but I'll take it for now. the emotions in the scene while at Nora's bedside were palpable. And I think that is one of their best scenes in the entire episode. And I really like that Nora called out to her mom a lot, because even though she's gotten to know Barry, she's historically always relied on Iris for comfort. So I like that that was shown. And I like that Barry finally came to the epiphany that he should appeal to Cicada's heart and not use his fists. I'm not sure Barry remembers that he can't really fight without his powers, so I'm glad he's back to using his emotions as a strength. And I love the scene where Iris catches Sherlock trying to interrogate Nora and goes all protective Mama Bear on her as well. On him. On his ass. I'm hoping that this could be groundwork for Iris to discover other things about Nora, since, you know, that scene might have been deleted in 5-8. So hopefully that goes somewhere. And then Cecile's entire storyline was one of the strongest in the episode, too. I really like that we get to see CCPD more because of her, though I also wish Iris had been involved in some of the investigation as well. But it was great to see Singh again, because he's my man and he needs to show up more often. And I like that she knew something was fishy going on at the precinct and she went after it. And yes, Ralph, I'm sorry. And I shouldn't be sorry. I'm surprised that I liked him this much, because we all know how we all felt about him last year. So who knew that I, May Abdulbaki, first of her name, would appreciate Ralph as the level-headed friend a year later. So I think he was great in his scenes with Killer Frost. And while I dislike the B-plot, he's come such a long way as a character. And speaking of the B-plot, what do we not like about this episode?
Yeah, well, first I have to say that, yeah, I did enjoy that final, like, Nora had to get her back literally thrown out and lose the loss of her legs for us to get, like, a family dinner scene that was just Barry, Nora, and Iris, and that nice little hug at the end, so that was nice, but there are a lot of things that I didn't like, and I probably would have included Cisco in my likes had he actually appeared in the episode. I think it's really annoying, and it was very blatant that the writers just don't prioritize stories for him. And I know Wenonon mentioned that possibly his absence, and I think it was like 504, could have been because he was filming that short story or the short movie with Melissa and Chris. But the fact that he hasn't really had a story arc this season, really. And the one that he does get, finally he gets some kind of point of view, some kind of point story in the previous episode, 510, and then all of a sudden he's missing completely. Like, you don't even follow up on that in 511. And it's really funny, because if you ask every one of the writers, like, who their favorite character is, or every time there's just something like, you know, if you could be one of the characters in the show, who would you be? They'll tell you that it's Cisco, unless you're Todd, and then for whatever reason it's, like, whatever version of Wells Tom's playing, because he's weird. But, like, Cisco is consistently one of the writer's favorite characters, and then they never write stories for him. And it's like the same thing as them agreeing with you up and down all day long about how great Iris is and how she needs more to do and how she should be a journalist and how that should be incorporated, when it comes time to actually write those stories for these great characters, well, they just don't want to do it. And it just makes
Jess, sorry.
No sense, and it's very frustrating.
It paused again. No, it wasn't too bad. It was just when you were saying when it comes time to write those stories.
Yeah. So they'll agree with you up and down all day long about how great Iris is, but when it comes time to actually write these stories for these quote-unquote great characters, they just don't want to do it. And it's very frustrating. You know, Ralph has had episodes where he's gone off to visit his imaginary mother. Sisko is doing imaginary things off screen, and everybody's doing these imaginary things off screen, except for characters that I wish would go off screen for at least one episode. And they never do. They always have a storyline in every episode. So The Flash may be the pop, and this is one of the other things. The Flash may be the most popular show in the Arrowverse. They are. But the writing and the creativity for The Flash is not on the level that would make it the number one show. It's the number one show because of, like, the characters, because of Barry, Wes Allen, all of that things. But if you look at just, like, the writing and creativity, they are the stalest of the Arrowverse family. Legends has so much creativity, and it should be ranked better than it is, honestly. Arrow has done a lot with their diverse writers' room and, like, revamping what they want to do, where they're going with their show. Supergirl writers are at least trying to do something with the whole storyline for their show. And Flash is just really stale. There's not a lot of creativity there. And it shows in the writing. And I think that it does have a lot to do with their really white bread writer's room. There's no diversity in the writer's room, so you get all these stale stories just, like, circling around each other. And then you have this episode specifically that's supposed to be about Barry and Iris a little bit, but mainly Barry and his anger at Cicada and his rage at Cicada critically injuring his child to the point that he can't see straight. And all that is just turned into Killer Frost episode, like Killer Frost and Friends happy hour, because you have her and Caitlin, you have her and Norvok, you have her and all this other stuff, her and Ralph. So you have, like, all of that going on, and it's complete with, like, Barney and Friends I Love You theme song, which is just, like, Barney, first of all, come on, like, how did she stop developing mentally at 9 in that flashback that Barney is the best that you can do when you're, like, feuding with yourself, basically? Like, I don't know. Anyways, Barry, first of all, like, as far as seeing red, he barely used a pedestrian level of anger. I was expecting to see, like, the season-long crossover when Barry gets, like, whammy by Rainbow Raider. That level of rage, that's what I was expecting to see. Instead, I got, like, that meme of, like, Arthur, like, squeezing his fist in suppressed rage. Like, just like, the fist thing. And that's all you get. Like, his rage is so suppressed that we need Empaths of Steel to be like, oh, well there, Tiger, to let us know that Barry is upset. Because it doesn't really come out at all during the episode. And personally, I feel like portraying anger is one of Grant's, like, weaker performances. It's one of the weaker emotions for him. Because I remember, like, the time I felt like I really could see Grant's acting is back, like, in the Trickster episode when he's supposed to, like, angry at Trickster and going off. I was like, this is a little bit strained. But I didn't even get that.
He's not yet mastered.
Not yet mastered it. And I don't know if it's just because he's not connecting with being a father, having a child, and that level of rage and understanding of what that would mean. I don't know if he's not connected that way. It was just really underplayed, and the stakes really never felt high for him versus Cicada. And, like, he hurt your child. Like, where's the outrage? Like, I don't know. Pretend Cicada is a fanboy that told you your suit is ugly, Grant. Like, I need it, like, I grew up in the theater community, Grant. Like, where is, like, deleting you, Grant? Like, where were those Grants? That's the Grant that I needed to show up, and I just didn't get it. And, like, his big fight with Cicada isn't even his, mostly, because Killer Frost has to step in and handle Cicada until he's weak enough for Barry to handle Cicada. And so it just kind of, like, cheapens the whole thing. And then speaking of Killer Frost, she and Caitlin took up space, all of space, in the two big plot lines. So they took up so much space in the Cure plot line, the writers had to write Sisko out of it. Like, there was no space for Sisko in this plotline about the Cure and the argument between Killer Frost and Caitlin. And honestly, like, she showed more rage in the A-plot than Barry did. And that was like the one emotion that Danielle was able to pull off and make me believe that Killer Frost had a vendetta against Cicada, more so than Barry, even though it's not her child that got injured or whatever. Killer Frost, in general, I thought was super childish in her arguments with Caitlin and the whole, like, making numbers in the asterisk and the whole Barney theme song was just really, really childish. And rather than get any kind of actual viewpoint from Frost on, like, maybe the progression of her journey from being a villain to now, which is what I thought we would get and which is what I wanted to get, like, this, how she felt about where she came from and the possibility of, like, losing that forever just because Caitlin decided to take care is what I wanted. What we got is just stupid, childish, you know, little antics and dragging that out, something that she should have already known, which is that Caitlin wasn't going to erase her. And I don't understand why they needed Ralph to mediate that shit when they, Killer Frost, like, literally lives in her, in Caitlin's head. So, like, y'all are as connected as any two entities can be connected. Why do you need someone outside telling you to talk to each other? That's literally all you do. Cicada continues to underperform. Chris Klein, I thought he was just doing it for, like, a thing once, but now it's a thing all the time, so his voice just kind of, like, gets on my nerves a little bit over the top. I don't give a fuck about Norvok's sob story about working at the zoo. I'm sorry, like, I don't care. I don't care how he used to be, like, a good person, because since he's connected to Frost, Killer Frost, that just only gave her more screen time, because now she has that third little side story with him. And I don't like Iris continuing to be, like, the only involved in episodes from the sidelines, as she has been for the past couple of episodes. And it's reaching, for me, 2A levels of Iris erasure, and I don't really have a lot of patience left for it at all.
Okay, so first off, I think it's really shitty that they purposely paralleled Nora having her back broken by Cicada to Barry having his back broken by Zoom in 206, but, like, the latter, you know, when it happened to Barry, it was after an episode's worth of build-up for it, and then the next episode was all about Barry's recovery from his perspective and his frustration of not being able to recover. And now it happens this time around, and Nora's injury is just, like, a random occurrence in the first scene of the episode, and then she's, like, shuffled off-screen as a symbol of Barry's invisible rage. So it's not fridging per se, but as Suara said on the Flash podcast, it is pretty damn close to it. And, of course, speaking on this, of the sidelines, I don't understand why the writers can't use Iris and her job the way that they've started to use the seals. Like, Iris is more emotionally intelligent than Barry, so, yes, it makes sense that she's, like, the one by Nora's side. And speaking of that, also, she could have been the one to talk Barry down instead of needing Cecile to do it with her brain powers, because you couldn't actually see it on Grant's face. But anyway, despite this, her daughter is still injured because of Cicada, so I would think that she would want to actively put herself out there and, like, do something to figure out what's going on, to stop Cicada or whatever, and not just be, like, the woman at home waiting.
Right.
At the very least, she could have written an article about the metahuman serial killer and then drawn attention to it. Like, maybe we could say, because this is the first episode where we saw CCPD actively involved in that, you know, aside from just be like, oh, here's a dead person, you know? This is the first time they're like, we have a serial killer on the loose and we have to stop him. You know, we know who he is, we have to do this, this, and this. So maybe CCPD could have, like, had it on the back burner because it's just metahumans and it's just criminal metahumans who are being killed. And then Iris wrote an article about it to draw attention to it, and then people were like, oh, unfair treatment, you know? And also, it's not just metahuman criminals now, XS was also attacked. So then people would, like, be like, no, we have to find this person! And that would push the CCPD to move faster. But they did not do that, obviously. She also could have helped Cecile put pressure on the feds, or she could have actively been suspicious of Sherlock's suspicions, as Jessica mentioned. You know, instead of just, like, having her walk into one random scene and then give her a badass speech to Sherlock, she could have actually been, you know, investigating Sherlock's investigating. But at least she made it into the episode, unlike Cisco. I do not understand how Cisco gets sent off screen without even a 15-second scene for Carlos to collect a paycheck when the entire episode revolves around Caitlin focusing on the thing that Cisco is doing off screen.
Right.
Like, I don't get it. And this is the second time it's happened this season. He was missing from an entire other episode, too. This has never happened before. Carlos has never missed seasons or episodes in previous seasons. So I don't know. He's supposedly the writer's favorite character. He is definitely a fan favorite character. There is no reasonable explanation for not including him. And again, like I said, if he's busy, they could easily work him into an episode for one scene. Like they did that time that Danielle flew to LA and she was not in episode 21. She just had that one scene which they filmed the week before. Caitlin's story is another instance of taking like five scenes when you only needed one. First, the metahuman cure is being reverse engineered from a material that does not affect Frost. Because she's not a traditional metahuman. So whatever you want to break down, like, oh, but she has dark matter, she doesn't have dark matter, oh, her dad did it, other particles, etc., whatever. All these things are irrelevant because we already know that Frost is not affected by Cicada's dagger. Cicada's dagger is made from the shards of the satellite or whatever, right? So therefore, using the shards of the satellite to create a metahuman cure would not affect Frost. And yet, we have a whole episode with Frost worrying about this, even though it does not matter to her. I'm sure the writers have forgotten about it, but I have not forgotten about it. Second, Frost should know that Katie would never get rid of her. Ralph shouldn't have to tell her or coax her into believing it, because she's literally inside Katie's head.
Right.
So it's just stupid. It's just a waste of everyone's time. However, I will say, and I didn't say it in the legs because I didn't want to put her in the legs, I did like that she did not get knocked out by Cicada. She got knocked down, but she didn't get knocked out. Improvement!
I liked her conversation with Ralph, and that was about it.
Acceptable. Finally, Grant's performance during the angry moments, like Jessica already said, it was just totally off. Like, and it's not just his performance. I think it's also in the writing and the directing, too.
Yes.
Like, there was no build to his actions. There's no reason for people to worry about them. Like, even if he had been, like, yeah, I mean, obviously he could have acted the lines much more angrily, but they were just, like, reasonable things. Like, yeah, you should leave, because Cicada is gonna kill you. Cicada has killed, like, 12 metas now. Like, what do you mean, what did he do to you? Kill 12 other metas? That's what he did to me? But anyway. Up until the moment where he was going to kill Cicada, like, that's, like, the only, like, dramatic moment. And at that point, like, when Nora showed up, she couldn't have fucking grabbed Cicada so they could take Cicada to jail? Instead, she just grabbed her dad and hugged him while Stu Cicada got away? Like, that was so forced, and I hated it. There we go.
I showed more rage in my dislikes than Barry showed in the episode.
Yeah.
That was so true.
I think there was more rage when he was confronted by Ragdoll. Like, I think that was just sad.
Yeah.
Yeah, this episode lacked so many things. Tension, heart, drive. Like, I was so bored watching. I know I was supposed to be emotionally invested just by the sheer fact that Nora broke her back, and oh my god, she might never walk again, bring in the concerned parents, but I felt almost nothing, and that's, like, definitely a sign that you've done something wrong. First of all, the whole A-plot was not given enough time to really shine because the B-plot largely distracted from it. We went from let's go after Cicada because he's killing again to Nora being hurt, and then straight to Barry's attempts at hulking out, but it all felt rushed and disjointed. And then Barry's level of rage, like you guys said, didn't feel natural enough to me. It was like a clash of poor writing and underwhelming acting. And I was thinking Barry would have the rage level similar to, like Jess said, what we saw in Flash versus Arrow, especially since his daughter was the one that was hurt. And he wasn't under some meta spell, but that was what I expected to see. So his rage was, like, really soft for me in that moment because he was supposed to be beating Cicada to a pulp, but I wasn't feeling it. And then in season two, we did have two-ish episodes of Barry's back being broken and then struggling to walk again. And it was like this angsty crisis. And now I know the storyline was supposed to be about Barry finally coming to the realization that he cared about Nora far more than he ever thought he would, but there was just no commitment to sit with the storyline any longer than needed from the writers. And so the plot basically became more important than the character development for all of the West Island family in this case, and especially to Nora, whose back was actually broken and was the one to physically suffer the consequences of the attack. And also, Iris's lack of an active plot is noticeable, and it has been noticeable. She's a parent now, too, so we could have spent more time with that conversation between Nora and Iris about whether or not she'd ever walk again instead of Nora asking her for time alone. Like, the questions were asked, let the character sit in some of those potential answers for longer than 10 seconds. And I also found it weird that it was Cecile who was the one who talked to Barry about his anger, and that Iris wasn't privy to any of that until Barry was beating up Cicada and realizing he wasn't going to stop doing it. She could have spoken to him, and it also helped us in the investigation of what was happening at CCPD. And then even better, like Tati already mentioned, I wrote in my review earlier this week that she could have written about Cicada targeting other metas like she did about DeVoe last season. Like, she did that. She alerted all the citizens of Central City that this was happening. Why not do the same for Cicada? And I didn't need Norvok's backstory because no one ever cared about him. He was like this amulet sidekick, and I don't need precious minutes wasted on letting me know he's not that bad of a person after all. So I thought that was a waste. And then even though Cicada was killing metas all episode, I still found him to be so lackluster and dull. Like, there's no excitement whenever he's around. And at this point, I actually prefer when he's not in an episode because he's not very threatening. And his story has seemingly come to a standstill. Like, he's one of the least interesting things about the whole season so far. And then finally, my biggest issue of the episode, and really what derailed the main plot to begin with, Killer Frost's bratty, childish behavior over the cure. It's like the writers use absolutely no logic when it comes to her storylines. Carlos filming a short film, and I stand by this because the short film is only 10 minutes, that it was only that he was gone for 5'3". There was no reason for him to not be in this episode, I think. Even like Tati said, for like one scene, two scenes, just like they accommodated Grant when he was filming the crossover, they could have done the same thing here. Like, it makes no sense. He still could have gotten something. So last week, he was the one who came up with the idea for the cure, and now he's nowhere to be found. Killer Frost also got mad last week about the cure being made, but it dragged into this week, and it was like really unnecessary. Her being mad that Caitlin got rid of her, or could get rid of her after she spent the entirety of 4B trying to get her back made no sense. Like, Killer Frost is literally a part of Caitlin's DNA and inside her head, like you guys said. So she should already know all of this shit. Like, why aren't they leaving each other sticky notes? I don't understand. And it also didn't make sense that she would care or feel threatened by the cure, given that it's been established that she's not a meta created from dark matter. Or if dark matter still exists inside of her, she's not the same because it was because of her dad. So that is exactly why she's supposed to be the key to defeating Cicada, because she's not affected by anything having to do with dark matter. Like, make it make sense. So they retcon her story every single season and from episode to episode. So I'd like a little bit more consistency. And I almost died of laughter when she told Cicada that he'll learn why they call her Killer Frost. And I'm like, what? You've never actually killed anyone, so how is that even a real threat? Like, the dialogue and her delivery of them was just really painful this episode and super distracting. And it's time to give this character a rest for a while because I'm tired of the nonsense.
Well, that brings up another point that just kind of threw me for a loop, was like the exaggerated, you know, yes, the hand movements and like the neck rolling and, you know, all this. Like, really? I don't know. It's very exaggerated. And like that's like when Danielle wants to be sassy, because Killer Frost is supposed to be like sassy Caitlin. Like, it's just really, it's exaggerated a lot.
Yeah, and there could be nuance there, but there isn't. Okay, so moving into happier things, predictions into what will hopefully be a few nice episodes coming up.
One can only hope. Would you like to? Well, I mean, I guess I'll just predict that. No, I have nothing. I have no prediction other than to agree with your prediction. So go.
About the doctor? Oh, yes. Yep. So, theory. Yes, so about the doctor. Screen Rant wrote up a theory article back in December that I'm now totally on board with, because it involves Grace's doctor, Dr. Ambrose, being the one behind keeping her in a coma and her wanting Cicada to keep killing metas. So maybe she has her own reasons for wanting metahumans dead, or maybe she just hates them just because. But this could, like, prove to be a more interesting twist than Cicada ever was interesting if it turns out to be true. And you guys agree?
Yeah, definitely. I'd agree with that one.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. I do have a prediction about future Iris. We just got the episode description for episode 14, which is called Cause and Excess. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it says that Iris' life is in danger, and when Iris is in trouble, Nora races to save her. I'm like, that sounds weird to me. So I think it's future Iris who's in danger.
That's
because that's the episode that Grant isn't in very much of, because he's on his honeymoon. And that's why he's got, like, some other subplot. Because, of course, if Iris was in danger, why would Barry not be racing to save her? Because he doesn't know, because it's future Iris, not current Iris.
I agree with you. And I was thinking about that. I was going to, since the episode just came out, I was like, I don't know if I want to like bring it up here. But I'm thinking that it's Iris that she's going to save. Because like you said, for Barry to be in a whole separate subplot when Iris' life is in danger doesn't really make sense. So I hope, I hope that in the future, her life is also in danger because of something that Eobard did. And that ties in there somewhere because he's supposed to be quote unquote redeemed. So I hope that is also part of it. So we can finally get this whole Nora stop working with Eobard thing and of that relationship.
I like it.
Yep.
I do too. Right, I actually agree with that. Yay.
Agreement.
All right, moving into Black Lightning, the Book of Rebellion, Chapter 3, and Jalitos Negros, which is the last chapter of this Jennifer and Khalil are on the run. While they're still on the run, Jennifer and Khalil succumb to their feelings for one another and begin planning their future together. Meanwhile, Jefferson approaches Henderson. Oh my god, approaches Henderson with a favor. So, what do we like about this final Khalil chapter?
Okay, China's acting. So all the awards, that was great. Like all the tearful scenes, of which she had a lot in this episode, were very emotional and heartbreaking. I really liked when she broke down in the train car, when Khalil gave her necklace back, and she was just like, you know, I feel really overwhelmed, and she was scared. She didn't want to lose her virginity in the back of a train car, which, girl, yes, let's not do that. The fact that she was so worried about what would happen to both of them and to Khalil, all that vulnerability was really nice to see. I think China knocked it out of the park. And then also, like that Jennifer, even though she hid from her mom, which was stupid, when Lynn showed up to the train park afterwards, she admitted that her mom had a point, and like she was the one to kind of make Khalil see like this kind of situation that we find ourselves in is really unsustainable. Like we can't be on the run forever. Because I was thinking like they're making all these plans, like they want to go to Bahia and study French and Portuguese and that. And me, I'm like, with what money? With what passports? How are you gonna do this? Like, am I old now that this is what's coming up to my mind? Like, all these like financial concerns. So I don't know. And then I will add Jordan into the acting accolades, honorable mention. Even though I don't like Khalil, I did like Jordan's acting. I thought he did a good job of portraying the kind of tragic character role that Khalil is. I like that Khalil took responsibility for his life choices and that he didn't like back down or back away or, you know, say you're wrong, Jefferson, when Jefferson like really came at him hard. I like that he was going to turn himself in. I thought his apology to Jennifer really showed a lot of growth, like their goodbye. And you can kind of tell that it was like a tragic goodbye. Like I think he knew he was going to die. He was just not going to make it. But his apology to Jennifer, I thought, showed a lot of growth. And I think it was important for Jennifer to hear because he said he would have gone to the march even if she hadn't asked him. And I think a huge part of the reason Jennifer chose to run away with Khalil and to keep running and not going back to her family was because of the guilt that she felt that she caused this situation. The path that Khalil fell down was her fault. Because she asked him to go to the march with her, and so that she's the reason that he's paralyzed, and so I think she's been carrying that around deep down for a long time. And so his releasing Jennifer of that burden was like releasing her from him so that she could move on and not continue to be dragged down with him. So that whole goodbye scene I thought was really nice, and their scenes together in total were kind of really, there's this like tragic undertone to them, and it's just like this, fake sense of promise, because they're making all these promises together about the future, and, you know, like, when I get out of jail, then we can start over, and all this kind of stuff, and you know that's not going to happen, and it's never going to be the case, and so them kind of, like, trying to find some kind of happiness when we know that tragedy is around the corner, I thought was, you know, really nice balance of, like, tension and all that kind of stuff, and just made it even sadder when the end does come, and Khalil does die, because I think he's dead. And I think Khalil knew that when he was leaving anyway. And then on the villain side, I like that the briefcase that we basically all forgot about back from the season one finale finally comes back into play. And that Tobias is all these like random moves that he's been doing all season that don't make any sense now make sense because we finally figured out that he got that information from the briefcase and Todd being able to crack the code and finally figure out what all he's doing this for. And this is a storyline that actually makes him feel like a central villain again and not just a person abusing Khalil. It, like, finally gives him something more important to do. And I think the Masters of Disaster sounds like it could be a super, super interesting plot. And I just hope it does not take forever to develop.
I totally agree that China deserves all the awards. She portrayed the rollercoaster emotions that Topher was going through beautifully. I really liked that Lynn was the one that found them and that her speech was kind of what pushed Jennifer to go back, and also that Khalil also acknowledged it was wrong with him to keep Jennifer running with him. And I also, I don't know, I thought it was fun that he was like, you know, I can't go back, and then he was there. He was there anyway. They didn't even have to talk about it. This is like, obviously he was coming back. And I did, another little fun bit that I liked was Khalil knowing that Jefferson was Black Lightning, because duh. Of course, Jefferson's Black Lightning, and then, like, not really caring. And Jefferson being like, you're lucky my family is here. It was, like, some humor amidst the tragedy. I really loved the Pierce sisters moment. I really missed them. So it was nice to see them in the same place again, talking, you know, sharing their little, like, secrets or not, and ribbing each other. I hope that we're going to get a lot more of that in the future. Overall, I thought the build to Khalil's gruesome, you know, death was really well done. Like, the writing was on the wall, but the tension kept building, and, like, it made you feel like at any moment, like, you didn't know which way it was going to go, even though, of course, we all knew which way it was going to go. So some great use of dramatic irony there. I like Todd. I think Todd's, like, fun. He's, like, a little snarky side villain. He's just, like, enjoying himself. He's learning the ropes, I guess, from Tobias for some reason. It doesn't really make sense as a character, but I like his line delivery, so I'm enjoying him. And we'll see how long it lasts that he is having fun at Tobias' side. How long before he becomes another Khalil? We'll find out. Yeah, that's about it.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't thrilled with another episode of Jennifer and Khalil on the run, but I'm glad that we actually got some good development from everyone because they both finally decided to do the wise thing and go back home. And it really pained me to see Lynn calling out to Jennifer, but I also like that she then agreed with her mom that she needed to go home and seek help because they were just going to continue being on the run forever otherwise. And I also liked how they were going to continue living. I also asked how they were going to continue living this life with no money. Like, it's just not realistic, that gift. So I'm happy Jennifer finally came to her senses. And China, I agree, did a great job with elevating the material. It was very emotional to watch her be so sad and resigned to the fact that they had to go back, and also thoughtful when she said she didn't want to lose her virginity on the train car. She showcased Jennifer's vulnerability really well. And then Lynn being prepared to go out and aid her family's search, even though Jefferson wasn't pleased, was really nice. Like, she was just tired of sitting around, so I'm glad she got in on some of the action and used her knowledge of Khalil's dad to put two and two together. And I felt largely detached from Khalil because of the storyline, but he really stood up for himself and finally owned up to his actions. And I really felt for him because I know he was scared, but he decided to do the hard thing anyway. And I think there was a lot of good tension in this episode. So by the time Tobias got to Khalil, it was brutal and heart-wrenching to watch how it played out. So what do we not like about this episode?
Well, it's no secret that this is my least favorite book of this season. I hate everything about it. I don't like the good girl, bad boy, teenage angst story. Like, again, like, I don't know. This is me, like, am I old now? It's like, this is a sign. Like, this is the moment that I realized that I am old or something. Like, I'm not part of the teen generation or whatever. Because I just did not like the whole story of them as a romance from mid-season one onward. But aside from this, episode being centered around my least favorite romance, I also didn't like how it halted the plot of every other character not named Tobias. So that there's only so much of Jefferson and Nessa and Gambie and Lynn like wandering around in circles that I can take. And they've been getting nowhere consistently for the past two or three episodes. So it's just kind of like really boring to watch them be like, where is Jennifer? I'm like, you're not going to find her. Because she's like, Jennifer is like rightly their priority. So them doing something else wouldn't make sense. But since the narrative also calls for the reunion of the family to be on Jennifer and Khalil's terms, like they have to be the ones to decide that running away is stupid and come back by themselves. And until they do that, the rest of the Pierce family can't do anything. They don't have anything to do but wait until Jennifer and Khalil decide to grace them with their presence. So they're just sitting around doing a whole bunch of nothing for scenes at a time. It's kind of like Arrow. Oliver can't do anything because Steven's not, they don't have his availability. So he just kind of sits around and does nothing for all episode until the very end when he gets the move. And it's the same thing that happens with the Pierce family in this episode, because they're waiting around for Jennifer and Khalil to accept them back into their story. I don't know if, like, Lynn yelled out her plea at every abandoned warehouse she visited. Like, she I don't know if she didn't really know that Jennifer was at that train car, or she just, like, yelling out the same thing everywhere at all these abandoned sites. But, like, thank God that it happened at this one so that they could go home and we could end this, like, search party. Because I was just so tired of it by the end. And then the other downside to Jennifer runs away from home is that it messed up the entire family bond that made season one so strong. Like, season one, the strength of that season was the strength of the Pierce family coming together. And when you take that away, it messes up the entire bond of the rest of the family. And, like, the Pierces without Jennifer are just a hot mess. They don't communicate well. Like, Lynn never told Jefferson that she did some stuff on her own and went to visit Khalil's dad and get information. Jefferson had his own freak out in the episode before, and which, by the way, that's how you show angst and anger as a parent over your child being in danger, Grant. So, like, when they're supposed, like, the part where they're supposed to pair up to search different areas, Lynn would rather go separately. So, again, it's them not working together as a family. It's them doing things separately. And the fact that Lynn had, like, she uses a shotgun to emphasize her point, and it's just a little bit, you know, over the top for me. Like, on the one hand, I get it. Like, I don't think Jefferson takes Lynn very seriously a lot of times because she's not a powered meta or she's not Gambie. On the other hand, I wish they had actually had that as a conversation and used it to unite the family, rather than have Lynn talk through her shotgun and call it a day. Like, it was like a little snap moment for, you know, the episode, but it wasn't, it could have been more than a comeback. I found it a little weird that Jefferson and Henderson almost didn't care if Khalil got killed by Tobias or not. Like, they're very, you know, willing to let Khalil just, whatever happened to him happened. And then, you know, he basically did get killed by Tobias, so, I feel like if Jennifer and Khalil had returned home an episode earlier when Black Lightning and Thunder first rescued them, I feel like there would have been more space for the range of Jefferson's emotions to transition from fuck that kid to help that kid. So he kind of had to go from fuck that kid to help that kid within a span of like 30 seconds, instead of having that kind of draw out over the course of one or two episodes, and so it feels a little bit rushed, and there wasn't like an opportunity for Khalil to actually speak candidly to Jefferson the way that he did with Jennifer, because there's that parallel when Jefferson is actually trying to help Khalil in the beginning and speak to him through that. It would have been nice to have like a complimenting ending scene for him and Jefferson to kind of like go back to that teacher-student relationship. Like, he reset the clock with Jennifer in their final scene. Over on the villain side, Todd needs to watch himself, to be honest. I know he's like, I agree with you, Tati, that his line delivery is funny, but I don't know how or why he's still bold enough to taunt Cutter. Like, never met before. He's not bold enough to do the same thing with Tobias, sure. And Cutter will actually cut him. So I'm not really sure where he's getting, like, all this, like, energy about it. I don't know. It's just, like, a weird thing for him to be, like, semi-jealous of Cutter's relationship or position in terms to Tobias. And then just Tobias, like, literally ripping out Khalil's spine, I thought was, one, gross. And two, should have killed Khalil immediately. Like, it's a nitpick, but Khalil should have died. Like, the spine connects all the nerves of the body. Or did the Black Lightning writers, like, not go to biology in school? Did they not take that class? I don't know. Like, you take out his spine, you sever all of his nerves, he dies. Like, he's not, like, struggling on the ground. And even if I do give him, like, his death struggles on Tobias' carpet, he's dead by the time they drop him off in front of that church. So, I mean, like, a little bit nitpicky. It kind of came off, like, Mortal Kombat-ish, but he should be dead. Like, it shouldn't be, like, a question. Like, he's dead.
Just as too impatient to wait till the next episode for them to kill him off.
Yeah, well, right? Took out his spine. Like, what else is there left to do?
I mean, yeah, that's
the
true.
Only thing I can imagine. The only thing I can imagine is that he still has a spine, just the broken one. You know, so he just pulled off the thing that lets him walk and gives him the powers. That's what I would imagine.
But it's still, it's still connected to nerves and tissues.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
they're just prolonging the inevitable
funeral in the next episode. But yeah, they're just prolonging it. They're just going to give him another paycheck, I guess. I don't know. We'll see. Anyway, dislikes. Yeah, I don't like that we wasted 3 episodes on Jennifer and Khalil's, like, lightning-fast romance just for him to then die and for her to step into her powers in that way. I don't see why she couldn't have just saved him that first time. Realized she can control her powers. Kissed him and then sent him on his way to, like, Mexico or Canada or wherever so he can be safe from Tobias and then just call it a day. Because I think that saving the dude she likes from the big bad would have been enough for her to realize that she has the power to control her powers and that she can use those powers for good instead of making Khalil's sob story her burden to carry from now on. Plus, I mean, I just, like, can't help thinking about Khalil's mom. Like, there was that scene where she was saying goodbye to him and it was super sad. Yeah. Now she's going to have lost, like, 2 sons to violence. And, like, I remember when she was, like, crying to Lynn about how she was, like, a bad mother because that happened. And then she's going to, like, feel that way forever. And it's just going to be off screen because they're not going to care about her off screen. And that bothers me so much. It reminds me of Luke Cage, season 2 of Luke Cage, where I can't remember her name. But do you know who I'm talking about? There was a witness.
And I never finished
that. That witness was killed. Oh, okay. Well, there was this girl. I can't remember her name. It's out of the sea. But she was going to be a witness. And Luke was supposed to protect her, but he didn't. She died. And then he went to the mom, who was talking about how she had lost a son as well. Like, her son had also died working for Cornelius Fudge.
Working for Ursula Lee.
Too much Harry Potter going on here. Yes.
But anyway, working for Cottonmouth. And that was so sad, and I never got over it. Like, I couldn't enjoy the season after that, because I was just, I kept thinking about that mom, who was, like, irrelevant to the show. But anyway, so.
But you cared.
Yes, I cared so much! Anyway, I totally agree that Jefferson and Henderson's emotional transitions were stilted, because they only got, like, 2 minutes to deal with what could have been a whole episode on its own. So, yeah, I was not. Like, even though I thought it was well done, like, the lead up to his death, I was just, like, from an outside perspective, like, from knowing that it was going to happen, it was just, can we just get it over with, please? Like, why? Why are we wasting everyone's time? So, yeah.
Yeah. What I think is interesting, and I just was thinking about, was that how we always thought that Anissa is most like Jefferson when it comes to, like, wanting to be a superhero and having powers, but now I feel like they're trying to parallel Jennifer seeking revenge on Tobias to Jefferson, because that's what he was doing with his dad. So it's really interesting.
Mm.
But I do echo both of your sentiments about this storyline. I'm so relieved that it's over. And even during this episode, everyone else's story was at a standstill again. And I think the writers have really thrown balance out of the window when it came to this chapter, because it was too heavily focused on a relationship that just wasn't good. And all they've been doing is chasing down Jennifer, and it got to be really exhausting. And I also don't like the fact that Jennifer's story, like you guys said, has centered Khalil so much, because it started off by saving him and now it'll continue with grieving him. And I think having them return in this episode back to the Pierce home didn't leave a lot of room to air out grievances within the Pierce family. So Jennifer, Jefferson, and Lynn haven't really gotten the chance to sit down and talk about her being trapped in the house, Jennifer's issues, nor have Jefferson and Lynn really wrapped their heads around the fact that they helped, in a way, push Jennifer away. So I feel like we won't really see any of the emotional fallout on the family because they're happy she's home, and now all their focus will shift to Khalil and Khalil's death, which has been prolonged since Cutter stabbed him with one of her poisonous knives. And I also didn't like the assumption that Lynn couldn't handle herself just because she didn't have powers, especially when Jefferson knows she's perfectly capable of defending herself. And finally, Todd. Like Jess, I do like him a lot, but getting $100K deposited into his account has strangely made him cocky. And it's not necessarily like a dislike so much as I'm worried because it could get him killed. So please, Todd, protect yourself. That's all. Predictions. What do we think is going to happen?
Well, surprise, surprise. The masters of disaster are outsiders villains. I looked this up when they revealed the project, the MLD project, because I wanted to see if my theory was correct, and it is. I think they are supposed to be, we're supposed to think they're in the sleeper cells that are underneath the clinic, which will move that Tobias storyline full force, I think, in the next couple of episodes, because now that he knows where they are, he's going to want to go in and get them by any means necessary. But I'm not counting out the possibility that they may already be out and about. Maybe they're sleeper agents. Maybe they know who they are. I don't know. It kind of takes me back to like the teleport meta that we saw in the winter season finale. And if he's a master of disaster, like I looked up who they actually are, and I think there's like 5 of them, and none of them have teleport powers. But that doesn't mean that the show could make its own modifications. But now I'm even more sure that teleport meta is somehow related to the Outsiders comics, and it's just once again reinforcing my prediction that season 3 is going to be heavily Outsider centric.
I'm going to agree with that prediction.
Yes, same, because I don't have another one, and also like you've already said, they've been heavily pushing Outsiders, even though to me it hasn't really been obvious because I don't know their names from the comics. But yeah.
The Outsiders characters or the Masters of Disaster?
The Masters of Disaster.
Oh, I think there's... Let me look it up, because there's... I know one, the only one that I can remember off the top of my head is Cold Snap, and then there's, like, a corresponding, like, Heat villain, like, Heat something. Members of the Masters of Disasters group are Cold Snap, Heatstroke, New Wave, Shakedown, and Windfall. And I think New Wave is, like, the ringleader of the game, of the gang.
Interesting.
Shakedown, like, okay, so New Wave, Becky Jones' power was water manipulation. She could become living water. She's the older sister of Windfall and is quite possibly insane. It's either Windfall or New Wave that's, like, the leader of the group. I can't remember. But Shakedown is a big man, very strong, almost invulnerable, and can generate powerful vibratory blasts. He tries to keep peace, but after opposing New Wave one too many times, she kills him, so New Wave is leader. Cold Snap is a guy, Daryl, was able to generate extreme cold. He was in love with Heatstroke, but could not touch her due to his cold power. So basically, they're Snowstorm. and he joined MOD to cure his condition. Heatstroke, Joanne, was able to generate extreme heat. Love with Cold Snap, can't touch him. Also there to try and cure her condition.
Sexy.
Windfall, Wendy Jones, had air manipulation abilities. She has sympathetic feelings for the Outsiders member, Halo, which caused tension, later leads Masters to join the Outsiders. So, and none of those sound like the guy from the winter season finale, but he still could be connected somehow, so.
Interesting.
But that's who we are looking to see. I think there's 4 of them on the show. I think they said there were 4. 4 Masters of Disaster. So 4 of these 5.
Also, I feel like they betrayed me because I don't know if it was Nafisa or Chantal that retweeted someone asking, like, I wonder what Grayson and, you know, Anissa will be up to this episode. I was like, ooh, Grace is in this episode? But I should
have. But no.
Nope.
Fail. All right. Moving into side B, Lady with Gumption nominations. Who do we vote for and why?
Cecile! Defend CCPD and the FBI, and she won!
I was struggling to come up with one for side B, so I'm going to go with you and say Cecile.
Yes, Cecile for sure. Is there anyone from Black Lightning?
I guess Jennifer for going home. I don't know. Side B's not going to win this week, I think, overall, anyway. But
yeah. All right. So
side A now.
From side A, we have Kara, we have Zoe, and we had
Emiko.
Emiko. And then side B, we have Cecile and not Jennifer.
If we're going to just begin by the process of elimination, I would eliminate Zoe.
Okay. I'd eliminate Jennifer.
And obviously
as well.
Jennifer. And obviously Jennifer.
Yes. I'm a real bummer. So we're left with Cecile, Kara, and Emiko. Top three.
I would go with Emiko.
Yeah. It was her introductory episode.
It's her introductory episode. She drove the plot. She drove the story. She was, you know, one thing, I don't understand how, because apparently her mom died 2 years ago, and I'm assuming that her mom is not an assassin. So she didn't grow up learning all of this stuff. But in 2 years, like, that's one thing that I would like to know, like, who trained her? Because she's, like, all of her level good. It took all of her, like, 5 years on Lianyu and in the Broadfoot to be where he is. And apparently she is at his level. So that's a little interesting. This little, I don't know how that worked out. But as far as her being with Gumption, like, she had the Gumption to come up with her own list of names and take her mother's murder into her own hands, so.
Yep, I agree with that. So Emiko is crowned our Lady with Gumption of the Week. This is the first for Emiko, so yay, Emiko, I'm hoping to see more of you.
the first that she existed.
So this ends our episode, Back to Life, Back to Reality. Again, you can contact us by email, ladieswgumption@gmail.com, on Twitter at DCTVGumption, or by Tumblr asks at ladieswgumption.tumblr.com. And we will see you next week. Or we will not see you, but you will hear us next week. Bye.
Bye.